It's business time, baby.
You are listening to Solo Monster Sounds Off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster.
Conquered. I'm home.
You're like fighting a woman?
You're saying Vince McMahon is stupid. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, my God. We're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
God, this dialogue is shit.
Who writes this stuff? Bruce?
Come over here and fight me.
I'm the Solo Monster, damn it.
Solo Monster. Who are you to doubt El Dandy?
Woo!
Well, he may no longer be the IWGP US champion, but Jon Moxley added another promotion's title to his resume last night in the form of the GCW title. Game Changer Wrestling held its Art of War Games last night in Hoffman Estates, Illinois, the same location as tonight's All Out pay-per-view. And it was promoted going into the show that Matt Cardona, who had taken the championship, I think it was just last month, off of Nick Gage, he would be issuing an open challenge for the title. And at first he introduced Frank the Clown as his opponent. He beat him quickly. Kill the Clown. That's what they used to chant at Doink. Kill the Clown. Then G. Raver made his way out. He had a group of druids with him. They were in cloaks. And Cardona took out a couple of the druids. Everybody else cleared out. There was one druid left remaining, and that druid hit a paradigm shift to Cardona and then revealed himself to be Jon Moxley. And the place went nuts, and Moxley gave Cardona a paradigm shift onto a bunch of light tubes and pinned him to become the new GCW champion. I was surprised to hear that Cardona's reign came to an end. He looked like he was having the time of his life. He was trolling everybody. He had another version of the belt made that spun. The champ is here. He put Velcro on the belt, which is just something you don't do. But they took the championship off of him and, you know, hey, get out when the going is good. I mean, the angle was still hot, I guess, before it could fizzle out. That and I think he said he may have had other bookings. I've heard that he's talked about that on his podcast. He's all booked up. You know, he's keeping busy. He's got a lot of things going on. But he probably got out at just the right time. If he's lucky, he'll get out without having to have a rematch with Nick Gage, because I don't think that would end too well for Matt Cardona. So I was surprised to hear they took the title off him, but when the match was over, Moxley was confronted by Nick Gage. And Moxley told Gage, you know where to find me if you want a title shot. Gage said, you know, you're the GCW champion, we're going to do this in a GCW ring. And the match has officially been announced for GCW's show in Atlantic City on Saturday, October 9th. Gage against Moxley for the championship. Their last match, or one of the matches that they had, the one they showed us clips of during Gage's Dark Side of the Ring episode, that was a very brutal affair. This one is going to be even more bloody. So if that's your thing, this is going to be like WrestleMania for all the fans of deathmatch wrestling. GCW, I mean, they know how to get people talking. I'll say that much after what happened with Cardona. Now this, stealing a little bit of thunder away from AEW, they get a lot of people talking. They got a huge, yeah, I call it underground following. It's not really, I don't know if underground is really the right word. I mean, they're a small promotion, but they've got a lot of big buzz going around them. So anyway, that's been announced for the 9th. And if you are a fan of deathmatch wrestling, I think you're in for probably the biggest match all year between those two. That's coming up next month. Coming up right now, you are listening to episode 720 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, September 5th, 2021, Labor Day weekend here in the U.S. And we have a Labor Day sale that is ongoing on Pro Wrestling Tees now through Monday. So tomorrow, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, you can get 20% off all Sound Off shirts when you use the code Labor Day, all one word. Labor Day, that's the promo code to use at checkout. We got a whole bunch, I think over 30 different Sound Off shirts up in our store. ProWrestlingTees.com/SoloMonsterSoundsOff. You got to type in the full name of the show and you can get yourself some money off. Some of you asked me about Audible as well. I've gotten some questions about Audible. They were transitioning over to a new a server or platform or something. So they were down for a couple of weeks. I believe everything is back up now. So if you are looking to cash in and get one free audiobook, you can use our link again, audibletrial.com/solomonster. You can sign up for the 30-day trial, get one free audiobook of your choosing, including Daniel Bryan's book. Daniel Bryan, that's a name you're going to hear me talking about in a little while. I have a feeling by the time tonight is over, you're going to be hearing that name a lot, but you're not going to be hearing Daniel Bryan. You're going to be hearing his government name. That's the name that you're going to be hearing. His book, though, is excellent, and you can get it for free when you use our Audible link. And of course, if you want to support the podcast, you may do so on thesolomonster.com. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout out here on this show, which is blasted out to everybody worldwide each and every week. I think some of you guys are bigger stars than some of the people on the WWE roster and the NXT roster, the way I rattle these names off every single week. There are people who can memorize some of your names. Like this guy, the Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton, Night Stalker, Nayef Alsafar, John Loose Cannon Lopez, Big Bear Brian Becerra, Killshot Keith Hart, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, Ostentatious Alan Carter, Max the Axe Velado, John Raging Mad Riffle, New York Punk Arnold Modesto, the Chicago Screamer Ian Noel Camelotes, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine Harrison Soep, the Alabama Assassin, Chris Young, the Bakersfield Big Shot, Steve Heredia, the Pastor of Pain, Damian Yule, the Goddess of Justice, Samantha Turner, and last but certainly not least, Caleb Showtime Lindley. Thank you all for your support. It means a lot. And of course, all of our new channel members on YouTube, your support means a lot as well. We have Sound Off Episode 11. From January 21, 2008 is now up for... Actually, that one I posted for all channel members. It's kind of a little sneak peek for the Superstar tier. Usually, though, the retro audio, that's an extra perk for the Legends tier. But if you want to listen to episode 11, which you cannot listen to anywhere else, you can find it on YouTube as one of our channel members. And we picked up a lot of new members in recent weeks, so I thank you for that. Hopefully, we'll pick up some more tonight. AEW All Out is tonight from the Now Arena in the Chicago suburb of Hoffman Estates. Not only available this time on Bleacher Report in the US, but also through Fight TV for the first time, which is how I'm planning on watching it, because I just think Fight TV is much more preferable than the Bleacher Report app. But the show sold out. The day tickets went on sale back in July. That was even before the rumors of CM Punk started circulating, so... they are going to have a packed house for the show tonight. This is the third all-out pay-per-view. The first one back in 2019 was headlined by Chris Jericho, winning the AEW World Championship for the first time, first champion, beating Hangman Page. Last year was Jon Moxley defending and beating MJF, defending the title, I should say, against him. And this year's show is headlined by the return of CM Punk to the ring for the first time in more than 7 years, one-on-one with Darby Allin. And the anticipated, not confirmed, but anticipated and expected debut of Bryan Danielson. All the rumors and stories seem to point to it. And every time I see CM Punk, and he's been doing a ton of media lately, every interview I've seen where Punk is asked about Danielson, I mean, he's trying very hard not to just come out and say it and blow the big surprise, but he can hardly contain himself. You could tell how excited he is to work with Brian once again. It's been too long. So I want to run down the card here. I did this on Friday night after the Rampage review, but I want to run through it again here, incorporating some thoughts, actually, now that I have seen the go-home show from Friday. Let's do the rundown and the predictions for the pay-per-view tonight. There was, of course, supposed to be a match between Pac and Andrade El Idolo, and that has been postponed due to what AEW claimed were travel issues. I assume those were travel issues involving Pac and not Andrade. But we now know that the match will take place on Friday. So this Friday on Rampage, the big main event is going to be Pac one-on-one with Andrade. I am looking forward to that match a lot. And as I said the other night, Andrade debuted on June 4th. In the 3 months since then, he has gone through two different managers and has wrestled a grand total of one match. That was a win over Matt Sydal at their Road Rager show back in July. So he has had a very quiet, very uneventful run so far. This is a big match for Andrade in AEW. This is going to be his biggest match yet. I'm sure he's going to go in there with Pac, and I don't see how they could have anything but a very good, if not a great match. But it's going to be more important for him than it is for Pac, because Andrade still has yet to make a mark. Malakai Black, I like what they've been doing with him. Andrade, though, I'm still waiting. So this is going to be a very big match for him coming up on Friday. By the way, there is speculation about Full Gear. That is the next pay-per-view coming up in November. And right, it was scheduled for November 6th. And some of you might even have tickets to go to the event if you live in the St. Louis area, which is where it's going to be taking place. But Full Gear is no longer listed on the AEW website under the events section. I believe it was there before. It is no longer there. There is speculation that they might move the show because there is now going to be two pay-per-view events airing that night, one being the Canelo Alvarez fight and the other being UFC 268 from Madison Square Garden. So they might not want to compete against both those shows. I don't know that they would want to compete against one of those shows, let alone both. So we'll have to wait for some kind of official announcement, but it would not shock me to find out that Full Gear is going to be delayed, maybe pushed back a week. I guess we'll just have to wait and see. But with Pac and Andrade off the card, the Women's Casino Battle Royal has been bumped up to the main card. And instead, on the buy-in, we're now going to get a 10-man tag with Jurassic Express, Orange Cassidy, Chuck Taylor, and Wheeler Yuta taking on Matt Hardy, Private Party, and TH2. I'm going with the baby faces for the win, just because. I don't have any particular reason, but I don't see Jurassic Express being on the kickoff show and losing, so I'm going to go with the baby faces. We have the Women's Battle Royal for a future AEW Women's Championship match. Riho is back. She'll be in the Battle Royal, as will be Nyla Rose, Jade Cargill, Thunder Rosa, Hikaru Shida, Emi Sakura, Ty Conti, the returning Anna Jay, who came back on Wednesday's Dynamite show to rescue Ty Conti. Big Swole, The Bunny, Red Velvet, Penelope Ford, Abaddon, Kylan King, Legit Layla Hirsch, Rebel, Jamie Hayter, Kiara Hogan, and Diamante. Julia Hart was supposed to be in the Battle Royal, but they did an angle on Dark. There's a special bonus edition of AEW Dark. It actually was up on YouTube last night, and there was a backstage segment where Julia Hart was talking about how excited she was to be part of the Battle Royal on Sunday. All of a sudden, here comes Nyla Rose, here comes Jade Cargill, they attack her, and they pilmanized her. They pilmanized this girl, which is kind of a cruel twist of fate, given that Julia Hart is associated with Brian Pillman Jr. And they pilmanized Julia Hart. But the reason it was done, and I'm not sure if she's legitimately injured or not, but she has been bounced from the Battle Royal. And what ended up happening is, on Dark, there was a match between Red Velvet and Sky Blue. Sky Blue is an independent wrestler. I don't know if she's local to Chicago or not, but she got a tremendous ovation from the crowd. Even in defeat, Tony Khan was so impressed that he came out onto the stage when the match was over. He summoned both women up onto the stage. They were walking together arm in arm. And Tony Khan said, "Hey, Sky Blue, how'd you like to be in the Battle Royal on Sunday?" And she was all excited. So basically, Sky Blue is getting the 20th spot that belonged to Julia Hart. I predict the Joker entrant will be Ruby Soho, making her AEW debut. I love the social media videos that she's been putting out the last several weeks. I think they're really well done. In the last one that she put out, she was in New York City. She made it to New York. Not Chicago. But I'm going to say that she's the surprise entrant tonight, but not the winner. And I was really going back and forth on two people who I think could easily win this Battle Royal, one of which is Thunder Rosa, the other being Anna Jay. The last we saw Anna Jay, she was supposed to wrestle Britt Baker in the Women's Championship Eliminator Tournament on Dynamite earlier this year, back in February. She suffered a shoulder injury. She couldn't wrestle. She was replaced by another person who is not a major name. Britt Baker won. And, well, Britt Baker is now the AEW Women's Champion all these months later. And so Anna Jay, I think, coming back and winning and saying, you know, you and I were supposed to go one-on-one in that tournament, and I got hurt, and I never got to have that match with you, and now you went on to win the title, and I want my shot. There it is. It's a very simple story. People like Anna Jay. It's not hard to see why. People like Anna Jay. She got a great reaction on Wednesday when she returned. So I could definitely see Anna Jay winning this Battle Royal. But I'm going to stick with my pick. My pick is Thunder Rosa. I know it feels early to do the match, but I think what happens here, obviously she has a history with Britt Baker. We know that. She has a win over Britt Baker in their unsanctioned match on Dynamite earlier this year. I would not do the championship change in their first match. I would think that they would have a match a lot sooner than Full Gear. And Britt Baker now has a new bodyguard in Jamie Hayter. I could see Thunder Rosa being screwed over in her match. And eventually it builds to another match, and that could be where Thunder Rosa wins the championship. So I'm not saying that Thunder Rosa should be winning the title, you know, this month or anything like that. But I think she wins the Battle Royal, and I think at some point, maybe on that Dynamite Grand Slam show, they could do the match between them. But I'm sticking with Anna Jay as a dark horse. If it's not Thunder Rosa, I think it'll be Anna Jay. Paul White makes his AEW in-ring debut against QT Marshall. The shorter this goes, the better off we will all be. Billy Gunn and his boys, Austin and Colton Gunn, turned heel and attacked Paul White with a chair, at least Billy did, on Wednesday night. Paul White is not losing his first match. He's not losing to QT Marshall. But why would they bother turning Billy Gunn against him if they weren't planning for something to happen during or after this match? If they weren't planning for some kind of big spot maybe here on this pay-per-view? I kind of threw this out there on a whim, half jokingly on the Wednesday stream. But the more I thought about it, I think that there's a very good chance that maybe this actually happens. Now, let's say Paul White wins. The Gun Club runs out to jump him. It's 3-on-1. All of a sudden, Shaquille O'Neal shows up as a surprise, and he helps Paul White clean house on Billy and his kids, which leads to Paul White and Shaq going nose-to-nose in the middle of the ring, teasing a future match. Shaq has said that he's not done wrestling. He's going to be back for another match in AEW at some point. He did the tag thing. I could see him wanting to do a singles match. And if there was anybody to do a singles match against, it's The Big Show, because The Big Show has been wanting to get him in the ring for a match now for probably over a decade. They've been talking about doing this match. Well, now's their chance to do it. I'm not saying it's going to be any good, but would it be an attraction? Yeah, it would be. But I'm picking Paul White to win the match. John Moxley takes on Satoshi Kojima from New Japan, former two-time IWGP heavyweight champion. The man is 50 years old, but he can still mix it up. It was disappointing that of all the New Japan names to go with, they went with Kojima here over some of the bigger names, the bigger current names they could have gone with. But I see this almost as the way I would do it is Moxley wants Tanahashi. They're going to do John Moxley and Hiroshi Tanahashi at some point. It could be a few months. So in the meantime, we could see Moxley running through different New Japan names on his way to Tanahashi. Kojima will be the first one. John Moxley is going to win this match. But then I'd love to see them get him in the ring with someone like a Minoru Suzuki again. And on Friday, and I pitched this and people seem to like it. I think it could work. It might be more comedy than anything else, but you got to get Moxley in there again with Yano. Yano handed Moxley his first loss since leaving WWE anywhere on the independent scene or in any other promotion 2 years ago in the G1. He beat John Moxley. It was a count-out win, but he beat John Moxley. If they fly Yano over here stateside for a match against Mox, I guarantee you, even the people that don't even know who Yano is, it would get over big. Dr. Britt Baker, DMD, defends the AEW Women's title against Chris Statlander, undefeated in 2021. She will be undefeated no more after this match. You cannot take the title off of Britt Baker right now. Britt Baker retains with some help from her associates. They did not just put Jamie Hayter with her as a bodyguard just for her to lose the title. That would be dumb. So Britt Baker wins. Miro defends the TNT championship against Eddie Kingston. We saw a final segment between them on Friday on the Rampage show.
Miro was out in the ring doing a promo talking about how he's, you know, God's favorite champion and he's the Redeemer. And out came Eddie Kingston. He had called Eddie Kingston's contract with AEW a charity contract. And he called him John Moxley's Bat Boy. And that brought out Eddie Kingston for a rebuttal. And Eddie Kingston said, "Your God is stupid. Your God isn't real." He was taking shots at Miro's God. And then he basically said, "Redeem these nuts." And he ran into the ring. And Miro hit him with the belt and was going to do some more damage in the ring. But the other thing that Kingston mentioned is he mentioned some of his moves. And he mentioned the DDT. And in storyline, they have been portraying the DDT as one of Miro's Achilles heels. Right? The anti-Samoan. Drop him on his head and you might actually have a shot at winning the belt. So I like that they at least took the time to try to establish that Eddie Kingston has a shot, even though he ain't winning the TNT title. But they tried. And the DDT is something I'm sure that he'll be going for and they'll be putting over on commentary. But in the end, I think he'll pass out in the game over submission and Miro will retain his TNT title. Chris Jericho puts his career on the line one-on-one against MJF. He will never wrestle another match in AEW again, Jericho said. If he loses, he'll go do commentary full-time on Rampage. If I'm being completely unbiased here, even though I do not need to hear Chris Jericho yelling in my ear every Friday night, MJF should win this match. MJF is going on to bigger and better things. I look forward to the day when he and CM Punk have their war of words on TV. And I think the match would be pretty good too. You know, we don't get to see MJF in the ring that much. You could probably count on one hand the number of matches, singles matches, that he has had this year on TV, and you might still have a couple of fingers left over. And it's not an injury thing, but they've kept him out of the ring, and it almost, in a way, it makes him feel a little more special, because we don't get to see him in the ring every week. But I also think by not seeing him in the ring, people don't really appreciate how good he is. He is a good wrestler. He doesn't do a lot of the flashy stuff like a Rey Fénix would do. But he is very good in the ring, and I don't think he gets enough credit for it. We might get to see some of that on display tonight in the match with Jericho. But if it were a perfect world, MJF would win. And Chris Jericho would be, he would be beside himself because he would not be able to beat MJF. MJF would go down as the only man that Chris Jericho could never, ever beat. I would have that as one of his accolades for the rest of his career. But Chris Jericho, you know, for a company that likes to honor stipulations, Cody, for example, lost a couple of years ago. He still hasn't had a title match. I can't see Jericho losing and not wrestling anymore. And if you just bring him back in a few months part-time, then you've reneged on your stipulation. I don't think that's something AEW wants to do. But I also just don't think Jericho's ready to hang it up yet. You're getting this whole influx of new talent. Do you really think he wants to sit on the sidelines and just do commentary? Because I don't. So while I would have MJF win, I don't think he's winning. I think Chris Jericho is winning, and I think MJF will be just fine. The Young Bucks defend the AEW Tag Team titles against the Lucha Brothers, Penta and Rey Fénix, inside of a steel cage. This is a rematch from the first All Out 2 years ago. That was a ladder match for the AAA Tag Team titles that the Lucha Bros won. I would have told you Young Bucks retain had I not seen the finish of the main event on Dynamite this week. Rey Fénix, the challenger in the title match tonight, took the pin on a Meltzer driver from the Young Bucks. I'm having a hard time seeing the Lucha Bros losing this match tonight. Now, the cage is there to keep all of the elite lackeys out of the ring. We'll see how effective that is. I do think that one or more of the people in this match are going to do something fucking insane from the top of the cage. Probably Rey Fénix. And that's a very high cage. If you saw the cage on TV this week, that is a very high cage. So I think we're going to have a lot of insanity in this match. But I think we're going to have new champions as well. I think Rey Fénix and Penta, they have not yet held the AEW Tag Team titles. I believe that changes tonight. And then, looking ahead, I believe they're going to defend the titles against Santana and Ortiz and FTR. Either in a three-way or a four-way, also involving the Bucks, at Arthur Ashe Stadium at the Dynamite Grand Slam show in New York City. It's going to be the largest crowd in AEW history. I still believe that's where Santana and Ortiz win the tag team titles. I think Penta and Phoenix, their reign is going to be very short. And I think it's going to be that really pushes them over to abandon Death Triangle and take Andrade up on the offer that he and Chavo have been making to them now for weeks. They've been talking about how, you know, Pac has you guys under his thumb and he's holding you back. I think the trio of Andrade with, you know, aligned with Penta and Rey Fénix could work. You know, Rey Fénix, the way that he wrestles, it's not really a heel style. I could see that being challenging, but I feel like they're going to win and it's going to be brief. They're going to lose him in a few weeks and then they link up with Andrade. That's my prediction. CM Punk, his first match in 7 years in Chicago, one-on-one against Darby Allin. This is the real main event. Regardless of where it's positioned on the show, this is the real main event. This is going to be a lot of fun to watch. I don't know what to expect from Punk. I haven't seen him wrestle since 2014. He could be rough around the edges. There could be ring rust. He could get blown up in the first 5 minutes. I don't know what to expect. But one thing I do know to expect is that these people in Chicago are going to be a lot more forgiving, I think, of him if he is, let's say, off his game than they would be of most other people. You're not going to be getting any boring or you fucked up chants directed at CM Punk. So I think it's going to be a lot of fun to watch. Sting has made it very clear that he will be there only to fist bump Darby as he goes to the ring, and then Sting is going to the back. He's going to let these two go out there and do their thing. It's not about Sting. It's about Punk, and it's about Darby Allin. We saw them have a little face-to-face at the end of the show on Friday night after Darby's match, his win over Daniel Garcia. Punk was on commentary, and Darby was getting jumped by Garcia in 2.0. And Punk came down to go after 2.0, and Darby did a big dive out through the ropes and took both of them out. They went face-to-face. That's how they went off the air. Punk is not going to lose his comeback match in Chicago. And the idea of doing a story where Punk is not the Punk that he used to be, he's lost a step, he's got to find himself, he's got to try to get back to his past glory, I don't know why you would want to position him like that. I'm just saying if that were the story, let's say. If he loses and that was the story they were going to tell, I don't like that story. CM Punk is a major star. You treat him like a major star. You don't treat him like an aging star. He's not that old. He's 42. He's not that old. I'm sure he'll be fine. But he should win this match. Darby Allin loses nothing in defeat. So I'm picking CM Punk to win. Kenny Omega defends the AEW World Championship against the Impact World Champion, Christian Cage. They had Omega drop the Impact belt to Christian to establish that Christian has a fighting chance here of being the AEW champion. And Christian is also still undefeated. So they've done everything they feel they can possibly do to convince you that Christian Cage could win the championship here. Christian Cage ain't winning the championship. Kenny Omega will retain his title. I thought their match was excellent a few weeks ago on Rampage, so I think the match is going to be great, but I think Omega retains. And I think when the match is over, the only question is who comes out? Is it going to be Hangman Page? Or is it going to be Bryan Danielson? If Hangman Page was going to be there, then he should have been in the match. So I'm going to say that it's going to be D-Bry, as Booker T would say. Bryan Danielson will make his AEW debut here. He will come out to either stare down from afar or get in the ring and confront Kenny Omega. That is how they will go off the air. They'll get people talking. They'll get people tuned into Dynamite on Wednesday to see what happens next. What does Danielson have to say? What does Punk have to say coming out of his first match? If I were Tony Khan, that's the way I would go with it. And that is your all-out card for tonight. Will we see Adam Cole? Adam Cole is officially a free agent. If they sign Adam Cole, there is no need to rush him onto TV. You got a lot of people showing up for the first time. I would save Adam Cole. You got a big show coming up in New York in a few weeks. I would save him for that show. And Fightful Select, and I got to mention this. We're talking about Adam Cole. Fightful Select had a report this week that people in WWE have told them that Adam Cole was very adamant Adam was adamant about keeping his Twitch account if he were to stay in WWE. And they said that it was considered, on his part, it was considered non-negotiable. And it looks like they may well have lost this guy because they weren't willing to play ball and let him keep his Twitch account. Now that, again, that's not confirmed. I'm sure that's not the only reason. Whatever decision he ultimately makes, wherever he lands, I don't think it's just going to be because of Twitch. But it sounds like it's a big part of it. And the idea that WWE would let Adam Cole walk, they care so much about this guy. They're making a big pitch for him. He had a personal meeting with Vince McMahon. He's been working for them for 4 years on that NXT brand. The fact that they would allow him to walk because they wouldn't let him Twitch is precisely the reason why he needs to get the hell out of there. And you know what? I understand it from WWE's part. Because if you let Adam Cole have his Twitch, then you open the floodgates to everybody else. I think the policy to begin with is fucking stupid. But I can understand why they wouldn't want to do for one, but not for the other. But that is precisely why he needs to leave. No company should look at their employee and say, you know what, you're not allowed to go on Twitch and stream video games under a completely different name that has nothing to do with Adam Cole or your wrestling persona. There is no company that should have that kind of power over you. And if they do, you have the power to walk away and go somewhere else where they value you enough to allow you to do those things where it doesn't impact how you do your job. And there's lots of other places, not named WWE, where Adam Cole could go ahead and do that. So if Adam Cole could go to AEW, and I'm sure he would make a decent living, and he can work in a place where he knows a lot of the people there, he's friendly with them, his girlfriend works there, he can keep his Twitch. I mean, we're checking all the boxes here. I don't see a reason why he shouldn't go to AEW. But that is your all-out card. I will be on YouTube Live as soon as the show goes off the air. It's going to be a late night tonight. So I hope you guys will stay up late with me. Probably around midnight or so when the event goes off the air, I will go live and we will recap all of the happenings. And I'm sure it will be a very newsworthy show tonight. I hate when I have to come on here and talk about another wrestling personality that we have lost, especially when they're young. But it's even worse when they take their own life. We saw it with Ashley Massaro 2 years ago. We saw it with Hana Kimura last year, and that was the awful situation that unfolded Wednesday night with the death of Shannon Spruill, better known to wrestling fans as Daphne, the Scream Queen from her days in WCW and later on in TNA. She was only 46 years old. She went live on her Instagram with a very disturbing video Friday night, clearly in a state of distress. I was getting ready to go live on YouTube as soon as Dynamite ended when I saw what was going on, which is why I was checking for updates during the stream to see if she was okay, because it was pretty scary stuff. She was crying, talking about not wanting to be a burden on her friends, talking about how alone she felt. She said the thing with CTE and concussions is that it can only really be diagnosed after you're dead. So I don't want to do anything to hurt my brain. I want it to be studied. I want the future generations to know, don't do stupid shit like me. Remember, my brain goes to Boston, straight to Boston. Boston being where the Concussion Legacy Foundation is based, which was founded by Chris Nowinski, Harvard Chris, from Tough Enough, who got signed to WWE and then suffered a very severe concussion early in his career that really ended his wrestling career before it even got started. And in the video, she was holding what appeared to be a pistol. Immediately, friends of hers from all across the wrestling business, including Mick Foley, were on social media pleading for anyone who knew her home address to let him know and let the authorities know. He said he tried calling her phone number, but it went straight to voicemail. Police went to her home to conduct a welfare check and met her mother there. Per TMZ, they knocked on the door. There was no answer, so they left without trying to get inside. They came back a second time hours later. This time they got a key to the apartment from the maintenance man, but it did not unlock the deadbolt. So they called the fire department and they broke the door down and they found her with a gunshot wound to the chest. As she said in her video, she did not want to do anything to harm her brain because she wanted it to be studied for concussion research and for CTE. In WCW, she played David Flair's deranged girlfriend. She managed him in Crowbar, Devon Storm. She even had a short run with the Cruiserweight title. She was cut by WCW a month before the company was sold to WWE. She did later get signed by WWE to a developmental deal, but she was released later that same year. In 2008, she signed with TNA. And on commentary, they would sometimes refer to her. I don't know if it was a Taz thing or somebody started referring to her as being zombie hot. She even has a t-shirt up in her pro wrestling tea store that says zombie hot, which is a great way to describe her. She had this girl next door vibe to her, if the girl next door had multicolored hair and tattoos all over her body. The following year is when she got hurt the first time, really badly, on a bump that she took from Abyss during his Monsters Ball match with Mick Foley at Bound for Glory. She climbed up on the rope. She got chokeslammed down through a barbed wire board on the floor. She suffered a broken arm, horrible concussion. In a blog post, Mick Foley said she was never really the same after that match, and I am so sorry that I was part of something that expedited the end of her in-ring days, and which also may have exacerbated the mental health issues in which she struggled until her death. Daphne struggled with mental health issues quite a bit. She took medication twice a day for a chemical imbalance that she talked about in an interview that she did with High Spots. She suffered from bipolar disorder. She suffered from severe post-concussion syndrome. Now, I should say that we don't know the exact reason that she ended her life. It may have been a combination of things, but her talking in that Instagram video about CTE and about sending her brain to Boston tells me that she still, after all these years, was suffering from the effects of not only that concussion in TNA, but other ones that she suffered during her time working there as well. In 2010, she suffered a third concussion and a stinger in a match against a student of the Team 3D Academy, which is run by the Dudley Boys, called Rosie Lotalove, which I think was a spoof on Rosie O'Donnell, if I remember. This woman had to be every bit of 250 pounds, maybe more. And she was totally reckless. She sat down right on top of Daphne. She just crushed this poor girl. And then she hit a sit-out powerbomb on her, which is probably where the concussion happened. That was this woman's tryout match. And they signed her anyway. And 3 months later, she was gone. And years later, she dropped 130 pounds and signed a developmental deal with WWE, and they put her in the Mae Young Classic, and she didn't last long there either. But Daphne really took a beating working for that company. And a year after her TNA run ended, she was in a terrible auto accident where her car hydroplaned and flipped over upside down in 3 feet of water. She escaped, thankfully. If she wasn't wearing her seatbelt, she thought that she probably wouldn't have survived. 4 years ago, she had neck fusion surgery because she was dealing with pain that was so bad, even with pain meds, she couldn't sleep. She couldn't think straight. Now, a lot of you may remember my rant about the way that TNA treated Daphne and really their overall poor treatment of their female performers back on Sound Off episode 156. That was in April of 2011. I talked a lot about Daphne and what happened to her. Terry Taylor promising that they would cover her hospital bills after the Bound for Glory bump and then later reneging on that promise, basically saying, you're an independent contractor, it's not our responsibility. And then when she filed a workman's compensation claim against the company, they let her contract expire. Daphne's issue with TNA was not one of greed. And in some interviews I've seen her do over the years, she's brought this up, and I think it's an important point to make, because some people would hear this story and think that she just wanted to, you know, sue them and get as much money as she possibly could out of them. Her story was not one of greed. When she was in WWE, she got hurt. When she was in OVW, she suffered, I think it was a dislocated kneecap. It was some kind of knee issue. And WWE took care of it. They got her a brace. They took care of her medical bills because the injury happened on their watch. Even though she wasn't on the main roster, she wasn't on Raw, she wasn't on SmackDown, it happened on their watch. And so they took care of it, as they should. In TNA, it seemed like if you were a big name, you probably would be okay. You probably would have your bills and stuff taken care of. You know, I doubt very seriously that if Sting got hurt in a TNA ring, Dixie Carter would have been like, tough luck, Steve, you're on your own. For someone in Daphne's position to TNA, she didn't seem to be much of a priority. What she did, she could have filed a personal injury lawsuit against them for damages. But she chose not to. She chose to file a workman's comp claim. Because what she was trying to do wasn't just to collect damages for herself and pay her bills, which were mounting at the time, but to clarify once and for all, definitively, in a court of law, that wrestlers are not independent contractors. They are employees. The company they work for controls so many different aspects of their life that they should be entitled to the same benefits as any employee would be. Remember the Jesse Sorensen injury when he was paralyzed briefly. Thankfully, he recovered from that, but it was a very serious injury. He could have lost his life. That was when Zema Ion, who is now Joaquin Wild on the NXT brand, he came off the top rope out on the floor with a moonsault and landed right on Sorensen's head, right in the wrong spot, and almost crippled the guy. Remember his story, and what Dixie Carter promised him and his mother in that whole fiasco, which I also covered at the time. Daphne tried to convince Jesse Sorensen to join in her suit with her, but he didn't do it. Yeah, maybe he was worried about being blackballed the way that she would have been. Yeah, you can kind of understand that, right? He was still young to the business at that time. Didn't want to close any doors that might be available to him in the future, so he didn't join in with her. He chose not to. The deadline that he would have had to have filed by, it expired. And then I think it was 3 or 4 months later, TNA let him go. You'll have a job for life, they told him. And they let him go. Right before the judge was about to make a ruling on the validity of TNA classifying its workers as independent contractors, and after the court had just ruled that Daphne's attorney could depose Dixie Carter, they reached a confidential settlement with Daphne. Surprise, surprise. Had they lost that claim, they and WWE stood to lose millions of dollars by having to change the way they classified their talent. It would have changed the entire wrestling business. It would have changed the entire landscape. If TNA didn't act when they did, I think Vince McMahon would have, even though he wouldn't have been able to pick Daphne out of a lineup, and none of this had anything to do with WWE, I'm sure they would have intervened, because the last thing they would have wanted was TNA's incompetence to cost them millions of dollars. But it never got to that point. They reached a settlement, and Daphne really wasn't allowed to say much about it after that. But what happened to her is a tragedy. It really is. And the fact that she felt like she was all alone, nobody should ever feel that way. Especially not someone who received the kind of outpouring of love that she received on social media from people who knew her, people who worked with her, who she helped along the way and befriended. They would have dropped everything they were doing to try to help this woman. A lot of them did try on Wednesday. That's part of what made this even sadder. Just, you know, seeing and hearing about the video and everything that was happening was bad enough, but then you see all these people who cared so much about her scrambling in just desperation, posting on Facebook and Twitter, please, does anybody have her address? Does anybody have her number? Please get in touch. I can't get her on the phone, and just feeling completely helpless. By the time they got to her, it was too late. But I wanted to share one story of a very nice thing that Daphne did. And I think it says a lot about who she was and her character. And I don't mean her wrestling character. I mean her character as a human being. It's a story Mick Foley talked about, as did Michael Bukkikkio. I hope I'm pronouncing his name right. He's the owner of Highspots.com, who was very close with Daphne, very friendly with her. Daphne was very good friends, once upon a time, with a woman named Vicki Lyons. Forensic Files, a television show, I know some of you might be aware of it, you might even be a fan of the show. Forensic Files did an entire episode about Vicki many years ago. When she was 4 years old, she was run over by a Ford pickup truck that backed up over her while she was playing outside. She survived, but she was left disabled. She had permanent damage to her skull and one of her eyes. They said that she would never be able to lead a normal life. She died 10 years ago of a brain aneurysm in her sleep. I think she was in her mid-30s. But before that, she had taken an interest in becoming a pro wrestler. She had already bucked the odds. I think she had gone to school and everything, and she was trying to lead a normal life. And she wanted to wrestle. She took an interest in it, and she went to wrestling school. And she trained to be a wrestler for 5 years. And she befriended Daphne during that time. This was before, I think, Daphne even landed in TNA. And Daphne spent hours upon hours with this woman so that she could live her dream of having an actual wrestling match. The one and only match that she ever had in 2008 was against Daphne, who of course put her over. That match is on YouTube, and knowing the story behind it and then watching it is a very cool thing to see, and a very cool thing that Daphne did for her. That's the kind of person that she was. It's a very sad end for someone who deserved much better. And I will second what a lot of her colleagues have been saying the past few days. If you are someone who is having dark thoughts, suicide is never the answer. You don't get a second chance. You don't get to hit the undo button and go back and do it over again. You can talk to someone. Reach out to some. Reach out to a friend. Reach out to a family member. It doesn't even have to be someone you know. But in this country, you can call the Suicide Prevention Hotline. There is a phone number that you can pick up, and everybody has a phone. Today, everybody has a phone in their pocket. And it's a free number to call. 1-800-273-8255. There's always someone that you can speak with. Believe me, it is always better than the alternative. Nobody should ever feel like they're trapped and only have that available left to them as an option. There's always someone there willing to give you an ear to talk about whatever it is that you want to talk about. They may not be able to help, but sometimes, you know, you look at this situation here feeling like I don't have any friends, I don't have anybody to talk to. You do. You may not think you do, but you do. Now, after Daphne's death, WWE sent out a mass text message to the entire roster, reminding them that if they're dealing with a difficult personal matter and would like to speak with someone, and in the message they provided the name of a counseling company with a phone number, they said you can contact them or you can contact WWE Medical. And I thought that was a very good thing for them to do. And I would hope that other companies would do the same with their talent as well. They would follow WWE's example here and do something similar. One person who did not think much of the gesture was Carl Anderson of the Good Brothers, who wins said tweet honors for this week. When Sean Ross Sapp tweeted about WWE sending that text message to its talent, if they're in need of help, Anderson tweeted back and has since deleted, saying, "They suck, bro." Despite deleting it, he went on a Twitter spree. He was replying to people with all kinds of just childish nonsense. Maybe it was in his mind he was being in character. Maybe he wasn't. I mean, that's an easy excuse for a lot of these, you know, idiots who post shit on social media to hide behind. Oh, I'm just being my character. I'm in character. I'm being a heel. No, you're being an asshole. I would say that he was drunk tweeting, but I don't want to blame the alcohol. He could very well just be that much of an ass. He's calling everybody marks and gloating about how AEW kicked NXT's ass on Wednesday nights. But that's not even the point. This all started because the man couldn't read the room. Even if you are cynical as to their motives, and you have every right to be, and he worked for the company, so he may have personal examples to share of situations where he felt WWE was not there for him or for the other talent, or that they caused certain situations that caused a lot of anxiety for people. It's very possible. I mean, there's also this congressional testimony from Vince McMahon admitting that the only reason WWE started offering free drug rehab for any of their wrestlers that have ever worked for the company was two words. Public relations. That is an actual statement from the chairman of the board. So it's not like we don't already know this stuff. People have every right to question their motives when it comes to stuff like this. You know what, though? It's still a great thing for them to offer, and it has helped a lot of people. But there is a time and a place to have a discussion about it. The fact is, mental illness, it is a serious problem. Depression, it's a very real thing. A lot of people go through varying levels of it. And if Daphne's story brings it to the forefront, even just for a little while, it's good on WWE's part to remind its talent that, hey, don't forget, we have these services available to you if you should need them. Get in touch. Maybe it saves a life. You never know. WWE, they didn't issue a press release about this. They didn't put it on their social media. They blasted it out to the talent, some of whom leaked it to the writers. That's how we found out about this. But a person just died. And Carl Anderson decides, you know what, now would be a great time to go on Twitter and make an ass out of himself and just go after WWE. He obviously realized it was a bad look, or else he wouldn't have deleted the initial tweet. But then he chose to go and make this about WWE. And go after the fans online. And all of a sudden, all the nice messages that I was seeing from different people talking about Daphne, it turned into RIP Daphne trending on Twitter to Carl Anderson trending on Twitter. And then once I saw why, I just sat here and shook my head and said, what the fuck? It's a good thing his first name ends with an L. Makes it easier to hand it over to him. Carl Anderson, your sad tweet winner for this week. Got some miscellaneous notes here. I watched the NWA 73rd anniversary show last Sunday. I enjoyed it, as I did their all-women's pay-per-view the night before. Just a few observations. I love the brawl in the loo, as they called it, with Tim Storm, Tom Latimer, and Crimson. A wild win for Tim Storm, 57 years old, going out there and having a match like that. And then coming back out and doing commentary for half the show. But I thought that was a lot of fun. Tyrus, I've not seen Tyrus in a very long time. People who don't know who Tyrus is, he used to be the Funkasaurus in WWE. Now he is actually a champion in the NWA. Tyrus is fucking awful. I cannot even believe that this man holds a championship in any company, let alone the NWA. What an embarrassment to the NWA. Ric Flair made an appearance. He was back at the Chase in St. Louis, a place that he is very familiar with from way back when. I was not expecting to see Ric Flair standing in an NWA ring thanking Vince McMahon and talking about how much love he has for Vince McMahon. He should love him. Vince has paid off a lot of Flair's debt to the IRS over the years. He didn't have to do that. I would love Vince McMahon too if I were Ric Flair. But this was vintage Flair. He was all over the place. He told a Harley Race story. He talked about working for Sam Mushnick. He praised Randy Orton and Chris Jericho and Tony Khan. He said he wanted Randy Orton to break his world title record, but now his daughter is going to probably be the one to do it. He thanked Billy Corgan for calling him to come to the show. He would have done it for free, even if he didn't pay him. I don't know about that. But, you know, he was Ric Flair. He took his jacket off. He was strutting. It was a Ric Flair promo. You just kind of let the man speak and do his thing, right? One last time in an NWA ring. So this was a lot of fun. You didn't know where he was going to go with this promo. There was a battle royal for a shot at the NWA national title. JTG was in there. Our good friend JTG, I've had him on the show a couple of times over the years. He was looking gigantic. If Vince McMahon took a look at JTG now, believe me, he'd have a contract slipped under his door in no time. He was the crowd favorite. He was my favorite in this battle royal. Instead, they gave the win to Judas, making his NWA debut, managed by Father James Mitchell. The Sinister Minister was back on pay-per-view. And I didn't recognize him, but Judas used to be Murphy in TNA of Gunnar and Murphy fame. And now Gunnar is on Monday Night Raw, and now we have Murphy back here in the NWA. So they had a heel go over to earn a title match against another heel. Because Chris Adonis, the former Chris Masters, is the champion. But this battle royal, this was pretty bad. Camille retained her NWA women's title over Chelsea Green. This was not nearly as good as the match the night before with Camille and Layla Hirsch. The main event I thought was excellent, with Nick Aldis on day 1043 of his reign as NWA World's Heavyweight Champion. He beat Cody Rhodes for the belt back at the 70th anniversary show in 2018. This was the 73rd anniversary. That's how long this man has had that championship for. He was defending it against Trevor Murdoch in a match where if Murdoch failed to win the title, he would retire. And as a protege of the late Harley Race, this meant something to Murdoch to be back at the Chase, challenging for the same title that Harley held 8 times before. So there was a lot of emotion coming into this match. The way they built this up, Murdoch's family was sitting ringside. His son was there cheering his dad on. Murdoch won the championship. I think it was with the big bulldog off the ropes. He gets the 3 count. Trevor Murdoch is the new NWA World's Heavyweight Champion. He invites his family into the ring to celebrate with him. Ric Flair comes back out to endorse Murdoch on the mic. This was great stuff. This was great stuff and a great feel-good moment to end the show. So on the whole, I have to give a thumbs up to both NWA shows last weekend. I thought they were, on the whole, very enjoyable. Some news on WrestleMania and Wrestle Kingdom next year. It sounds like there is a very good chance that WrestleMania will be running 2 nights for the 3rd straight year. This, according to Fightful.com, it was a little odd that they did not list a specific date when they ran an ad for next year's WrestleMania during this year's WrestleMania. They mentioned that it would be in Dallas. They kept it vague, though, and only said April of 2022. They usually give a specific date, and they didn't do that. And I had assumed at the time that that was because they were keeping their options open, and they didn't know yet if they were going to run back-to-back nights again or go back to the one night. And it sounds like they may have made their choice. And if this holds, that means that WrestleMania would be held on Saturday, April 2nd, and Sunday, April 3rd, in Dallas. The last time they were in that stadium in Dallas, they announced a record crowd of 101,000 people. They're not doing 100,000 people back-to-back nights. They might do 100,000 people combined, but they're not doing 100,000 people back-to-back nights. Doesn't mean they won't claim it, but they're not doing that. And New Japan Pro Wrestling announced that January's Wrestle Kingdom event will, for the first time, be a 3-night event celebrating New Japan's 50th anniversary. The first 2 nights will take place January 4th and 5th at the Tokyo Dome for the 3rd year in a row, with the 3rd night taking place on January 8th from Yokohama Arena. So they are not running back-to-back-to-back nights, and they are not doing back-to-back-to-back shows in the Tokyo Dome. The third night is going to be in a different building a few days later. I'm just hoping we see a big AEW name like Bryan Danielson working on one of those Tokyo Dome shows. That's what I want to see. I want to get Danielson in there. I don't even care who it's against. I don't even care who it's against. It could be against the Will Ospreay. It could be against one of the top Japanese stars. Whoever it is, I want to see Bryan Danielson in a Tokyo Dome, either main event, co-main event, call it whatever you want. I know we're still several months away, but that's the one thing I'm hoping for. Assuming he lands where I think he's about to land, that's where I want to see him. I want to see him wrestle at the Tokyo Dome on one of those nights. And I've got some late news here on the G1 Climax. We now know when it is going to be taking place and who will be taking part. It kicks off on Saturday, September 18 in Osaka, concluding with the finals at Budokan Hall in Tokyo on October 21st. The participants for each block were announced during the Wrestle Grand Slam show that took place on Sunday. So these are the names in the A block this year. We have Kota Ibushi, Tomohiro Ishii, Toru Yano, Shingo Takagi, who is the reigning IWGP Heavyweight Champion, Tetsuya Naito, Zack Sabre Jr., The Great Okan, Kenta, Tangaloa, and Yujiro Takahashi. And in the B block, we have Hiroshi Tanahashi, Kazuchika Okada, Hiroki Goto, Yoshihashi, Sanada, Tai Chi, Jeff Cobb, Evil, Tama Tonga, and Chase Owens. And just looking at the two blocks here, if I had to venture a guess and give an early prediction who I think ends up winning the G1 this year, Ibushi won it last year. I don't see him going back-to-back. I'm going to go with Okada. Yeah, he's felt phased down recently. I think he wins the G1 and he goes on to challenge for the championship at Wrestle Kingdom. That's my early prediction. Vince McMahon was said to have ripped up the script for Monday Night Raw multiple times this week. PW Insider said that he was extremely unhappy with the original plans and requested new ideas, which he then disregarded and he booked the show himself. 2 hours before they were to have gone live, there was still no plan for the show. I would love to know what the original script looked like that sent him over the edge, considering the shows that we usually get, that he apparently has no problem with. What must that script have looked like for him to be that irate? They had promoted 3 matches in advance for the show, which is rare, and not a single one of them actually took place. Bobby Lashley was supposed to wrestle Sheamus. John Morrison was supposed to wrestle The Miz, coming off The Miz turning on Morrison. And Eva Marie was supposed to wrestle Doudrop. But Doudrop attacked her before the bell and Eva could not continue, so we never got the match, which is perfectly fine by me. Miz wasn't there at all, and there was no reason given why. Now we know. PW Insider broke the news that Miz has been cast in the upcoming season of Dancing with the Stars, which premieres on ABC September 30th. So the Miz is going to go away for a little while. I don't know if there'll be time for them to do the match with him and Morrison before the season starts. Probably not. He's probably already preparing and getting ready. You know, he's going to be doing a lot of dancing, apparently coming off a partially torn ACL. But it doesn't look like we're going to be getting that match anytime soon. Out of all of this, though, with all of these changes, we ended up getting a triple threat match for the United States Championship with Sheamus, Drew McIntyre, and Damian Priest. That was excellent. So that was a change for the better. Thanks, Vince. That was a hell of a match. I don't know what made him so upset, but what he should have been upset about was that abomination between Charlotte and Nia Jax. One of the worst matches of the year. And what made it even worse is that Nia pinned Charlotte clean in the middle of the ring, which means we are going to see it again. And we won't have to wait very long for it because Nia Jax is going to challenge for the Raw Women's Championship tomorrow night on Raw. Nia Jax. Let's talk about Nia Jax. She made her in-ring debut 6 years ago. She is a product of the Performance Center. She didn't work elsewhere. She didn't work independence or anything like that. She went right to the PC. Didn't go to some, you know, wrestling school somewhere. She went right to the PC. And she was trained there to become a professional wrestler. So she is a product of the Performance Center. But really what she is an indictment of the Performance Center. Or you could say maybe she's more a product of just being called up way too soon, which is also true. She has been on the main roster now for 5 years. And in those 5 years, she has not shown any improvement whatsoever. You go back and watch a Nia Jax match from 5 years ago, and there ain't much difference than a Nia Jax match today. She has been reckless with countless people. I said years ago, the worst thing the WWE ever did was call her up as early as they did because the PC was made for people like her to stay and learn and hone their craft and improve or not improve. And if they don't improve, they don't get called up. That's how the system should work. It was made for people like her to gain experience, to try to get better. They called her up way too early, and it's evident every time she sets foot in the ring. She had a match with Charlotte on this show that broke down into a complete mess. It was not a worked shoot. It was a bad match where they started shooting on each other out of frustration more than anything else. Started out at the beginning as a very basic, boring match because Nia really can't do anything. There was a spot where she could have easily broken Charlotte's either her shoulder or her collarbone. She's lucky she didn't. It looked like she was dumping her for a back suplex, but normally the person executing that suplex would bump down to the mat with their opponent. They would also fall down. Only Nia didn't do that because she's fucking lazy and she didn't want to go down. So she stood there. She dropped this woman down, and my exact reaction when I saw her drop her was, Jesus Christ! Those are the first two words out of my mouth. Then there was a sloppy-looking Samoan drop. You know, just because a lot of these people don't actually end up breaking something or being injured. You know, Charlotte in this match, Kairi Sane in the match that she had on Raw with Nia last year, although she did split her head open on the ring steps. But I'm thinking more of the buckle bomb spot in the corner. You know, Ember Moon, whatever it was that happened there, Ember's husband tweeted at the time and then deleted a message calling Nia an unsafe moron. I mean, you don't have to be injured and carted out on a gurney to still look at the things that this woman does and say that she is reckless and the moves look like shit. They don't even look good. There's a difference between working stiff and just being reckless and not giving a shit. There's a lot of guys who work stiff. That's the whole Japanese style. People work stiff. At least their shit looks good. But that's completely different than what we're talking about here. They call her a monster. They book her this way because on TV, oh, she's a monster. She's a monster. Why is she a monster? Because she's larger than everybody else on the roster? Shouldn't she be offended by this? That they call her a monster? But that's how they book her. They book her like a powerhouse. But she has no power. Which I think is part of the reason why when she picks these women up, it looks so bad. And I cringe when she tries to throw them or she drops them. She's not that strong. But that's not how they portray her and they book her on TV. You know, at some point in all of this, the train went off the track. Charlotte started to smack her around and paintbrush her. Nia smacked her back, which she's certainly entitled to do. Charlotte hit the ropes. You know, and Charlotte is not blameless in this either, because Charlotte probably was trying to figure out, what the hell do I do here? She went to go hit the ropes. She came off the ropes like she was walking as slowly as possible. But I mean, what could she do? I'll defend her a little bit too on this. What could she do with this woman if she's not going to cooperate? What is Charlotte supposed to do? I've never seen Charlotte look as unsure of herself in the ring as I did here in this match. I don't see Charlotte having this problem when she's in the ring with Rhea Ripley. I don't see her having this problem when she's in the ring with Sasha Banks or even Nikki Cross. I doubt she would have this problem in the ring with Alexa Bliss or anyone else. Only Nia Jax. What is she supposed to do? Nia hit an ugly-looking spinebuster. There was a terrible backdrop. Charlotte went for her moonsault. Nia kinda sorta got her knees up. And then it was fight night. They both looked pissed off at each other. And finally, Nia hit a choke bomb, the Raquel Gonzalez finish, and she pinned the champion right in the middle of the ring. These two have never worked well together, and yes, I am thinking about that one other Raw match that's the first thing that comes to mind. They don't work well together. This match did nothing to make me want to see them in the ring again. But we're going to get part two, round two, on Raw tomorrow night. The entire women's division on this show right now is in shambles. And Nia Jax does absolutely nothing to make this division any better. You know, Raw tomorrow night is in Miami. They're going to be in Florida. They're in Miami tomorrow night. Nia Jax should be in Orlando, not in Miami. Rhea Ripley and Shayna Baszler had a good match, which was only there to give Nia Jax a reason to give Ripley a Samoan drop when it was over, and give one to Nikki A.S.H. on the floor. This was obviously before the match that Nia had with Charlotte. Ripley introduced Nikki at the start of her match to be in her corner. Nikki came out, she didn't get much of a reaction, because this character is death. I don't like this association with Nikki and Rhea. It feels forced. It came out of nowhere. I mean, they worked against each other. Now, all of a sudden, they're buddy-buddy. Rhea is cool. Rhea is supposed to be cool. Nikki is not. This association does not work. The Viking Raiders, they got a win over Jinder Mahal and Veer. And they pinned Mahal. They didn't even pin Veer. That was a surprise. You know, this loss coming off the quick loss to Drew McIntyre at SummerSlam doesn't bode well for Jinder. Damian Priest, he picked up the biggest win of his career, pinning Drew McIntyre in a triple threat that also included Sheamus. I know Priest just won the U.S. title at SummerSlam in front of 45,000 people, but this felt like a bigger deal. Him pinning Drew McIntyre in this match felt like a bigger deal. These three had an excellent match, and they gave them time, too. They gave them just over 20 minutes. And, you know, for all of the NXT flops that we can point to, people who were misused, Damian Priest has not been one of them. There was a spot that I loved in this match where Sheamus went to superplex Priest off the top while McIntyre was hung upside down in a tree of woe in the same corner. And Drew pulled himself up at the last second and suplexed both of them, Tower of Doom style, backwards. That was very cool. Priest stuck to Claymore kick that was intended for Sheamus and hit McIntyre with the Reckoning for the win. After the match, McIntyre shook hands with him and basically endorsed him. He put him over, you know, as a new face here on this brand. I thought this was great. Everything about this was great. This was the highlight of Monday Night Raw. We got footage of a WWE cameraman stalking and harassing Bill Goldberg as he was hobbling into his truck. He said that he had ligament damage and he was scheduled for knee surgery. He said, Sundberg is at home, his neck is all jacked up after what Bobby Lashley did to him at SummerSlam. He said, he's not coming for the WWE Championship. He's coming to rip Lashley's soul out of his chest, I guess Mortal Kombat style. At least it won't be for the championship. We have him on tape. We have him now on video saying that. I want it in writing. When they do the rematch at Sweet Saudi Money 6, it should be non-title. Because, you know, my biggest fear, we knew the match was going to happen. I told you the match was going to happen. It seemed obvious the match was going to happen. During my SummerSlam review, I talked about this. They didn't shoot that and do that angle at the pay-per-view that way to not come back and do a rematch. And my biggest fear, looking at the timeline here, was that you got Survivor Series coming up, and they're going to do Raw versus SmackDown again. And my fear was, and frankly, my fear still is, I don't give a shit what they said here, my fear still is, they're going to do the match in Saudi Arabia, Goldberg is going to win the championship so that they can set up Goldberg one-on-one at Survivor Series against Roman Reigns. Because you know they've been dying to do that. They were going to do it at WrestleMania last year until Roman said, bye-bye, pandemic, I'm staying home. So it is very possible we could still get Goldberg and Roman Reigns at Survivor Series. The fact that he went out of his way to say that it's not about the WWE Championship gives me some hope. But I still want it in writing. I want it notarized by a notary public. Stamped, legally enforceable. This will be a non-title match. Until then, I'm not convinced. Eva Marie against Doudrop. Never happened because Doudrop beat her up before the bell and counted her own fall. That might have worked for Steve Austin in some of his matches back in the day, but that don't work for Doudrop. And then when the referee said Eva was not able to continue, Doudrop grabbed the mic and she announced herself as the winner, which of course is something that Eva had been doing. If you knew nothing about this show, if you don't watch Monday Night Raw, which by the way is an increasing number of all of you who listen to this podcast, but if you don't watch this show and you knew nothing about these two, you would think, based on what I just described to you, that Eva was the babyface and Doudrop was the heel. But that is not the case. At least not yet. Can you imagine these people trying a double turn with these two? I put nothing past them. But no, Doudrop is the babyface and Eva is the heel. But Eva got beat up before the bell and Doudrop, she celebrated. John Morrison did not get his match against The Miz. Instead, what he was gifted was a quick loss to Omos in about 2 minutes. And RK-Bro beat Lashley and MVP. Lashley was trying to win a second championship here. He wanted the tag team title, but MVP ate the pin from Matt Riddle. After the match, Orton laid out Lashley with an RKO, so they may be setting up Randy Orton to challenge Bobby Lashley for the championship at Extreme Rules because they got nobody else ready. Look at that roster. Who is ready to challenge Bobby Lashley at the next pay-per-view for the WWE title? I don't really have a better answer for you. The Goldberg rematch is going to happen, but it's not happening at Extreme Rules, and it may not even be for the title. McIntyre has been moved down the card, which I don't think is a completely bad idea. Damian Priest, I mean, they're giving him the push, but he's not ready yet for that spot. And that's really it. You got a heel in Sheamus. AJ Styles is still stuck doing the tag team thing with Omos. You know, John Morrison just, you know, didn't really turn, but I mean, he got turned on by The Miz. Well, that sounded wrong. The Miz turned on him, and they're only now starting to build up Morrison as a babyface. Didn't do a very good job of it, given that he got his ass handed to him this week. And he's still doing that dripstick stuff. So, he ain't it. Who else is there? Outside of Randy Orton or Matt Riddle, there really is no other good option right now. Keith Lee, they're trying to figure out what they want to do with him. He's trying to get his win back after the, you know, he's been out for so long and the COVID stuff. So, we don't even know if he's going to be back on Raw. They don't have anybody else who's ready for that spot. So, if they want to go at Randy Orton, you know what? I don't have a better option for you. Fine with me. At least Orton and Riddle together are over. Now over on SmackDown Friday night, I enjoyed the Universal title match between Roman Reigns and Finn Balor. And I thought Bianca Belair had a strong promo in the ring with Becky Lynch. Becky came out. She talked about how she's being made out to be the bad guy here, even though the fans certainly are not treating her that way. So it's another one of those things like 3 years ago where they're having to have her make claims that really don't hold any water based on what our eyes are seeing and what our ears are hearing. The people haven't yet turned on her, so I don't know what she's talking about. I don't know who these people are who are criticizing her for the way in which she won the championship at SummerSlam. Bianca came out. She said that she was embarrassed to lose the title in 26 seconds, but she was not going to build herself up by bringing somebody else down. She said Becky would not give her her rematch, so she went out and she earned it like everything else she does. And she challenged Becky to make like Roman Reigns and put her title on the line tonight. And the crowd cheered like they wanted to see it until Becky said, I don't give a damn what Roman Reigns does. The answer is no. And she walked away. Which got some boos, but it wasn't an overwhelming number of boos. You know, like with Steve Austin 20 years ago, they're going to go to the playbook. They're going to try a lot of very heelish things to try to get this woman hated and booed. The question is it going to stick when it comes time for the match? And we'll find out at Extreme Rules, but I thought Bianca's promo game here was strong. This Friday, SmackDown is at Madison Square Garden, and they are going to have a contract signing. I would be surprised if Becky Lynch goes into the Garden on Friday and gets anything but a babyface reaction in New York. I may be more interested watching how the crowd reacts on Friday than anything else. The alien probe has been completed, and Toni Storm has been returned to planet Earth. Toni Storm lives! Dolph Ziggler spotted her backstage. She was just randomly standing around. I'm sure when the aliens beamed her down, she was all disoriented, didn't know where she was. She was just standing there. And so he went over to go talk to her, and she said, "Ew, a jobber, get away from me." You couldn't hear it, but she definitely said that under her breath. He wanted to know if she was planning on watching his match against Rick Boogs, and she said she was, but that she would be rooting for Boogs. So already, he's been friend-zoned. Look at this guy. What a fucking loser. And he was a loser. He lost to Rick Boogs in about 90 seconds. Cesaro and Seth Rollins, they were having a good match until the finish, when Rollins used a chair to block a running uppercut from Cesaro, so Cesaro basically gave the chair an uppercut. That was good enough for a disqualification. Rollins got a few chair shots in. He was about to execute a one-man concerto before Edge ran down to make the save, and later on backstage, Edge challenged Seth Rollins to a rematch this Friday at MSG, even though he already won the first match, and said that he was going to be focusing on the Universal title. He gave Rollins exactly what he wanted. And they're going to have their rematch on Friday night. I guess we'll see maybe if they do some sort of non-finish that builds to a third and final match at Extreme Rules with some kind of extreme stipulation. That's pretty much where I think things are headed between these two. And I think in the end, Rollins will win the feud. They did a Kevin Owens show segment with Happy Corbin as his guest. Corbin then introduced Logan Paul as his invited guest. Logan Paul does not respect the brand split. First he's on Raw, on Moist TV. Then he shows up on SmackDown on the KO show. At least this time he was actually positioned as a heel, which is the only role he should ever be in. This guy gets heat. I'll say that. And if you remember, Kevin Owens gave him a stunner at WrestleMania. So there was some lingering heat there. There's some history there. He shoved Owens. Owens shoved him back. When Owens went to go attack him, Corbin hit Owens in the head with a microphone. Gave him a choke slam while Logan laughed about it. So this looks like it's leading to a match. I don't know if it'll be a singles match. I don't know if it'll be a tag team match and Owens have to go find a partner, who that would be. If Logan Paul has agreed to a match, it could be Extreme Rules or it could be the Saudi show next month. Maybe they do boxing rules. There was another French-Canadian who once had a boxing match in a WWE ring, Ray Rougeau. Right, we covered this on This Week in History a few weeks ago. Ray Rougeau was just a one-off thing at a house show, but Ray Rougeau had a boxing match back in 1996 against Owen Hart. Maybe this time it'll be KO and Logan Paul. Although I know Owens is not very fond of Ray Rougeau's brother. There is some, at least from one side, there's some heat from Kevin Owens' side when it comes to Jacques Rougeau. He doesn't have a lot of nice things to say about him and the way he trained him, or the lack thereof in terms of training. Leading into the main event, there was some drama over whether or not Brock Lesnar might show up. He had called Paul Heyman in the middle of this show. I love how Heyman had Brock's theme music as his ringtone when he called. And Heyman told Roman Reigns, "We got a problem. Brock Lesnar called me. First time in a year that I've heard from him. And he informed me that he will be at Madison Square Garden next Friday." Roman laughed at the thought of Lesnar watching the show. I mean, look, we know Brock doesn't watch Raw. He told us as much once. Remember? "Paul, I don't watch the show. Those were his words. Brock Lesnar is a smart man. But apparently he watches SmackDown. Heyman said, well, Fox must be big up there in Saskatchewan. And Reigns wondered how Heyman knew that Brock was in Saskatchewan. And Heyman kind of stumbled and stammered and said, I don't. Maybe he's in Minnesota. And Roman all of a sudden was paranoid that Brock might show up tonight during his match with Finn Balor. Now, before the main event, Balor got jumped by the Usos on his way to the ring. They busted up his ribs with the ring steps. The announcers wondered if he would be able to continue. I enjoyed the match. Balor hit the shotgun dropkick in the corner and the double stomp off the top for a very close near fall. When Reigns got the shoulder up on the kickout, he low-blowed Balor. And the announcers wondered if that was intentional or not because Roman has a history of doing this. And I thought to myself, he does? I don't remember. He probably did do it in one match before. I thought he had done it in the match with Drew McIntyre at Survivor Series, but I think that was different. He gave Drew a blatant low blow, I think, after a ref bump. I don't think that was a low blow on a kick out. But they made it sound like he does this in every match. He does not do this in every match. In fact, I'm struggling to remember which match it was before this that he did this in, but I'll take their word for it. But he did low blow Balor. Reigns locked on the guillotine choke, put Balor out for the win. As Reigns and Heyman were walking out, the lights briefly went red for a second, and you could hear a heartbeat sound. And then it quickly went back to Roman's theme music. So they are teasing the Demon. Balor is bringing back the Demon, probably for Extreme Rules. We have not seen the Demon in more than 2 years. He has been dormant. He has been quarantining from COVID, waiting for his booster shot. And now he is ready to make his return. Now, Brock Lesnar is being advertised for MSG this Friday. They're billing it as a super show, so there should be some stars from Raw on the show as well. I don't know if that'll be on TV or if there'll be some Raw people who were in dark matches that night when they go off the air. I don't know. I don't see them going to the Lesnar match this soon. I think they do the Demon at the next pay-per-view, and we're probably looking at Roman Reigns and Brock Lesnar at Sweet Saudi Money next month. I would rather they save the match for Survivor Series in Brooklyn in November and just forget all about this Raw versus SmackDown stuff, all this non-title stuff. Like, you know, I think one or two Raw versus SmackDown matches or like a Survivor Series elimination matches as an attraction, I think is fine. You don't have to abandon it completely, but there's no need to fill the entire card up and down with Raw versus SmackDown and do a bunch of meaningless non-title matches. And we've gotten some great ones before, don't get me wrong. Last year, Roman Reigns and Drew McIntyre had an excellent match. We've seen Brock Lesnar and Daniel Bryan, Brock Lesnar and AJ Styles. So we've gotten some really great matches out of it in the past, but in this case, I think the bigger main event for that building, for that pay-per-view, would be Roman Reigns against Brock Lesnar. And look, you could call it Raw versus SmackDown. Technically, Brock Lesnar is still on the Raw roster. If you go on WWE.com, his profile is still on the Raw page. So there you go. There's your Raw versus SmackDown main event they could do for Survivor Series. Brock Lesnar against Roman Reigns. And I already pitched the idea a few weeks ago on how this plays out. Because if you're going to have Raw versus SmackDown and the mixing of the brands on that show, you could do an angle where we get that first confrontation with Brock Lesnar and Bobby Lashley, and you can start planting that seed for a match at WrestleMania next year. Now, speaking of Balor, he did an interview with BT Sport and said something very interesting that really depressed the shit out of me. He said that when he found out that his run on NXT was coming to an end, he pushed to move to the UK for a while so that he could do a program with Walter. Walter and Balor, they were going to work against each other before COVID ruined everything and the program got dropped. And that just makes me so sad that we never got that Balor against Walter match, because that would have been fantastic. We have one more taped episode of NXT before we see the new NXT, the revamped NXT, the revamped look, anyway, of NXT, which is going to debut on September 14th. We got a brief glimpse in their newest coming soon commercial for the new NXT, what the upgraded CWC is going to look like, the way they have the seats set up, almost like, it looked like Theater in the Round style. Not really all that unlike how the Thunderdome was set up, only this time we'll have actual people this time. So it might look better. It might actually be an upgrade and an improvement on the current setup, and they're going to change the lighting and everything because the show is kind of dark. I'm more interested, though, in what the actual product is going to look like a few months from now. I'm not so much interested about the lighting. I'm not so much interested about the seating or the logo. What is NXT going to look like? What are the stories? What are the matches? What are the push talents? What is it going to look like in November, in December, in January? That's what I'm interested to see. We had a match between Saray and Mandy Rose. Saray did this running basement dropkick. Mandy was sitting on her butt up against the ropes. Saray comes in, running basement dropkick, looked like she wrecked her. And Mandy fell out of the ring. There were some reports that had leaked that Mandy may have suffered an injury to her face during the tapings. You know, having seen this, this was total angle. Gigi Dolin and JC Jane were in Mandy's corner. They quickly covered up her face with a towel and they whisked her away. Clearly, this is part of a storyline, but I will say that dropkick looked fucking badass. We had a solid outing, I thought, with Duke Hudson losing to Kyle O'Reilly, tapping out to the heel hook. Ilya Dragunov, the new UK champion, came to the ring one last time for now on NXT proper. He is on his way back to the UK, but he wanted to come out and show the fans that he is alive. He's alive and well before he goes back home. And he said, I like it here. I really do. You'll be seeing more of me again in the future. He said, the ring general has fallen. Long live the Tsar. We had Arash Marchese conducting a sit-down interview with the newest addition to the NXT Women's Division, the former NXT UK Women's Champion, Kaylee Ray, who talked about how NXT needs a new top player in the Women's Division. William Regal knows exactly what she's capable of. And he interrupted a few times and was asking, well, what are you capable of? And she said, anything I want. And she also ran down some of the women on the roster, including Ember Moon, who did not take too kindly to her comments and said as much later in the show. So the two are going to have a match this Tuesday. It'll be Kaylee Ray one-on-one with Ember Moon. You know, between Dragunov, who is going back now to NXT UK. But we had Dragunov, we had Kaylee Ray. Later on in the show, Imperium had a match. They got a win. We've got the grizzled young veterans on the show. Even though they were just doing some comedy this week with Cameron Grimes in the back. But a lot of UK influence on this show, which is not a bad thing. We're seeing more and more of it. LA Knight got a win over Johnny Gargano, who had Dexter Lumis and Indy Hartwell in his corner. Dexter and Indy are going to be married next week, not this coming week. They're going to have their wedding on that first live episode back of NXT. But Gargano here got knocked off the apron at one point. Dexter caught him. He fell into the arms of Dexter Lumis, who saved him. But all of this created a distraction that led to Gargano being DDT'd and pinned. So Gargano was not very happy about this. He blamed the loss on Dexter. He's still doing the comedy stuff. You know, I read that one report a couple of weeks ago about how the plan going forward is to position Johnny Gargano as the top heel on NXT. I'm entertained by some of this stuff, but I don't see top heel when I look at Johnny Gargano. They're going to have to make some kind of major change. He's going to have to fucking bloody up Dexter Lumis at that wedding and just completely snap for me to buy him as the number one top heel on this brand, because I'm not seeing it. Mei Ying of Tian Sha will finally wrestle her first match this Tuesday. She should beat up Boa. Everybody else already does. Let her beat him. Wade Barrett earlier in the day had conducted a sit-down interview with the NXT champion Samoa Joe. And Joe talked about how busy he's been and all the different hats he's been wearing. He was at the recent Las Vegas tryouts scouting for new talent. He hopped on a red eye across the country back to Orlando for his takeover match against Karrion Kross. Talked about carrying on the legacy of the NXT Championship And he asked, who on the NXT roster would step up next and seize their destiny? Well, I do believe thy name is Pete Dunne. He would seem to be Joe's next opponent, and then it should be Walter. Not that it will be, but it should be. You know, I was thinking about this also. I would not mind LA Knight getting a run with the championship either. I mean, his age aside, and I only mention his age because we keep hearing about how they're looking and investing in younger people, and LA Knight is 38 years old. His age aside, I would think Vince McMahon would love someone like LA Knight. He is someone who would fit in perfectly right now on the Raw roster or the SmackDown roster. You know, and since they're wanting to apparently weed out the people, and this is what Nick Khan said, they want to weed out the people that they do not see as having a future on the main shows. Well, if that's the case, then LA Knight is one who absolutely should fit the mold that they're looking for. I said mold, not mole. But I think, look, if they wanted to give him a run as the NXT champion before he gets called up, I'd be fine with that. I think he's great. And I was surprised to see Tommaso Ciampa get a clean win over Ridge Holland in the main event. Holland's first major loss. That was coming off his win over Timothy Thatcher the week before. Now, it's just one match, but maybe they're starting to build Ciampa back up again as a player in the singles division. You know, he was eyeballing Goldie when Joe held the title up on TV a few weeks ago. He couldn't take his eyes off that title. And it's been a long time since Tommaso Ciampa has really been any sort of focused singles competitor on the roster. Before the team with Thatcher, he feuded with Thatcher, and that was not exactly a main event feud on NXT, although they may have had a main event on TV one week. But you know what I mean. I mean, Ciampa is a former champion, and he really hasn't been positioned that high up on the totem pole in a while, so it makes me wonder if maybe he's going to ease his way back up into that spot. Maybe he would be an opponent, you know, a television opponent one week for Samoa Joe. If they wanted to do an NXT title match, they could put those two in the ring. I'm sure they'd have a badass match.
History has been made here!
This week, in wrestling history, the final installment, 1 year later. Let's do this. 42 years ago this week, on September 1st, 1979, I covered this a year ago, but I'll mention it again here. WWE introduced the Intercontinental Championship, claiming Pat Patterson won it in a tournament in Rio de Janeiro, unifying his WWF North American title with the South American Championship, even though no record exists of there even being a South American Championship. On that same date, 31 years ago in 1990, came the Memphis wrestling angle with Jerry Lawler and Eddie Gilbert, where Gilbert ran down Lawler with a car and nearly killed him. USWA general manager Eddie Marlin fired Gilbert and his brother Doug in storyline and escorted them out of the studio into the parking lot. Lawler came out to chase him off. Eddie and Doug got in their car and they started driving towards Lawler and Marlin. Marlin moved, but Lawler jumped up. As the car approached, he hit the windshield, he bounced off the car, landed hard on the pavement, landed right on his hip, and rolled a few times as the car sped away. Gilbert thought he had killed him, like legitimately killed him, as they drove off. He thought he was going to be wanted for murder. And the fans watching live were freaked out. They thought Lawler was either dead or crippled. One fan in the studio, at least one, called an ambulance. Other fans called the cops, who came to the studio looking to arrest Gilbert. Lawler was forced to go back out later in the show in front of the crowd and let them know that he was fine, which he really wasn't, but at least to let them know, I'm alive, I'm okay, so that the cops wouldn't arrest Gilbert and wouldn't put, I guess, a warrant out for his arrest. 31 years ago this week, on September 5th, 1990, Clash of the Champions 12, Mountain Madness, aired on TBS from Asheville, North Carolina, featuring Kevin Nash's WCW debut, sporting a mohawk, as Steel of the Master Blasters. It was Master Blaster Steel and Master Blaster Iron, who sucked. He was replaced right after this by Master Blaster Blade. But this show is most remembered, not for the Master Blasters, but for the Black Scorpion. This was the Black Scorpion angle. This was when Jim Herd was running things in WCW, which should tell you all you need to know. And he was coming up with all sorts of cartoonish ideas for gimmicks, like he was trying to make WCW something more closely resembling what Vince McMahon was doing at the time with WWE. Well, Ole Anderson was the booker. And Ole Anderson was not about any of the cartoonish stuff, so you can imagine how happy he was around this time. I don't know that Ole was ever happy. I think he was born pissed off. But it got to the point where he would just start throwing out these really outlandish, ridiculous ideas in meetings with Herd, and Herd would always reject them, until one day, Ole came up with this idea for there to be a mystery man under a mask, somebody from Sting's past. Sting was the champion at the time. And now this person is back to either get revenge on Sting or torment Sting. And much to Ole's chagrin, Herd actually liked the idea. And he said, let's do it. Let's run with it. So now Ole came up with this idea as a joke. And now he's got to use it, having no idea who the Black Scorpion would even be. They hadn't thought that far ahead yet. Ole did the voice for the character, giving him the distinction. This serious guy, Ole Anderson, has the distinction of being the voice of two of the biggest flops in WCW history, the Black Scorpion and the Shockmaster. But a lot of fans who knew Sting's past as part of the Blade Runners started thinking that maybe it was the Ultimate Warrior, even though Warrior at the time was the WWF champion. And I don't think they minded playing off those rumors, because in The Torch and in The Observer, it was well documented that Vince McMahon was not happy about Warrior's performance as champion around that time. So maybe, right, just maybe, it was the Ultimate Warrior. But nope, it was never going to be the Warrior. On this night at the Clash, Sting retained his title over the Black Scorpion, who on this night was played by Al Perez, who would quit the company shortly after this. After the match, a second Black Scorpion appeared on the ramp, and this would continue to drag out all the way until Starrcade, because Ole had no idea who the Black Scorpion was going to be. They even had an army of Black Scorpion jobbers, or excuse me, messengers, that would wrestle on TV and lose. Finally, in December, Sting wrestled the real Black Scorpion in a cage match, and he unmasked him afterwards, revealing that it was Ric Flair. This was all very, very dumb. 29 years ago this week, on September 1st, 1992, at a WWF Superstars taping in Hershey, Pennsylvania, Ric Flair won his second WWF championship from Macho Man Randy Savage in a match that had to be taped twice and did not air for 2 weeks on Primetime Wrestling. 12 minutes into the match, the first time they tried to tape it, Vince McMahon was so unhappy with it, he sent Bobby the Brain Heenan down to the ring to signal to referee Earl Hebner that he wanted everybody to head back to the locker room. And Howard Finkel made the announcement to the live crowd, this match will continue as soon as the referee regains control. And they all went to the back. And after a few squash matches in between, Flair and Savage were sent back out to the ring to wrestle another 25 minutes, which is what aired on TV, with Savage selling his injured knee from SummerSlam a lot more than I guess he was doing in the first match. If you remember the SummerSlam match at Wembley Stadium, Flair and Perfect went after Savage's knee. So they were playing off the injury here. In fact, it played into the finish of this match. Razor Ramon came out during the match. Flair had locked Savage in the figure four leg lock after Razor had interfered. And Savage passed out from the pain, which allowed the referee to count three and award the title to Ric Flair. Flair only had the title for 5 weeks before losing it to Bret Hart in a match that did not air on TV at all. Two very hastily done title changes that year, as they were obviously transitioning over to younger, newer, different faces on top. This was when the heat was really on Vince and the company with the steroid stuff.
28 years ago this week, on August 30th, 1993, SummerSlam was at the Palace in Auburn Hills. I always thought of this show when I thought about the Palace, until the Malice at the Palace in 2004 with the Pacers and the Pistons. That was crazy. 9 players were suspended as a result of the brawl that ensued that night. This show was a lot more tame. Ted DiBiase wrestled his final match for the WWF in a loss to Razor Ramon. His troubles at home and his marriage were mounting. He was doing things he should not have been doing. So he left to return to All Japan Pro Wrestling, where he spent time in the 80s tagging with Stan Hansen. And he would have a lot of time off at home between tours, which I guess he felt was preferable to the WWF schedule. And obviously he wouldn't have all that time off working for Vince McMahon. He went back to tagging with Stan Hansen in September, and they won the tag team championship just 4 days into his first tour. And 2 months after that, he injured 2 discs in his neck, which led to him retiring from the ring for good. He would be back in the WWF by January as an announcer at the Royal Rumble. Shawn Michaels retained his Intercontinental title over Mr. Perfect by countout in a disappointing match. This match had a lot of high hopes. I think a lot of people had high hopes coming into this match, given who was involved. This could have been a classic. It could have been on the level of, you know, Bret Hart and Kurt Hennig, the, you know, 2 years before at SummerSlam. But it was not to be. It was anything but. It was also the first SummerSlam where the Intercontinental title did not change hands. We could have had a Bret Hart versus Hulk Hogan match on this show as well. But Hogan was already gone from the company. He finished up with the WWF earlier in the month on a European tour. This, after dropping the championship to Yokozuna at the King of the Ring. Now, Bret claims that backstage at WrestleMania 9, Hogan thanked him and told him he would be happy to return the favor to him, as Bret did for Hogan by stepping aside. And, you know, Hogan, of course, beat Yokozuna that night in 90 seconds or whatever it was and won the championship. So this is what Bret claims, that Hogan said he's willing to return the favor. In his book, he claims that he was summoned, Bret was, to a secret photo shoot with Hogan backstage at the Superstars taping in Halifax, Nova Scotia on May 24th to shoot promotional materials for SummerSlam, where the two of them had a tug-of-war over the WWF belt in this photo shoot. 5 days later, he says Vince McMahon called to tell him that he was going to get the belt back, and not to talk to Hogan because he hadn't called Hogan yet to tell him the news. Fast forward 10 days, Bret says Vince called him again, and he warned him, "I've got bad news." Hogan was refusing to put him over, and instead he would drop the belt to Yokozuna. And Vince said he was going to have one more meeting with Hulk to try to change his mind, but if not, Bret would be working instead with Jerry Lawler at SummerSlam, which would explain why the angle was done at the end of the King of the Ring, after Bret won the crown. Now, of course, Hogan denied all of this and told Bret that Vince told him the match would be non-title, and that once Vince said the match would be non-title, he simply refused to do it because he didn't think doing the match was worth it. But as Bret pointed out to him, he said, "Terry, we did the photo shoot in Halifax, fighting over the belt. Why would he have us do that if it wasn't going to be for the championship?" So we never did get the match, not until both of them were in WCW years later. And Bret was to instead wrestle Lawler, but Lawler that night showed up on crutches. He was feigning a knee injury from a, he said, horrific auto accident earlier that day. Had to pull himself from the wreckage. So in his place, he sent his court jester, Doink the Clown, to face Bret Hart. And not for nothing, they had a very good match. I enjoyed the match between Bret and Doink. Evil Doink. Evil Doink was the best Doink. But Matt Bourne was a good wrestler, so the two of them went in there, they had a good match. Lawler smashed Bret at the end of it right across the back of the head with that crutch. I mean, he absolutely smashed Bret Hart with this crutch. It was a stiff shot. And Bret Hart gave Lawler his receipt at the end of their match, which
immediately follow the Doink match, because I think it was Jack Tunney came out and said, you've got to wrestle. You know, Lawler was trying to get out of it. So they did the second match immediately after the Doink match. At the end of it, Brett locked Lawler in the sharpshooter, and for about 4 straight minutes, he refused to let go of the hold. He said he was trying to hurt him on purpose. And Lawler, screaming in the hold, may have been more shoot than work. Lex Luger, the face turn on the Intrepid, is what built to this main event here on this show. Vince wanted a new Hogan, is basically what happened. He knew Hogan was gone. Hogan was leaving. He had just lost the championship. He needed a new top babyface. He already had Lex Luger on the roster. Luger was a heel. He was the narcissist. He was full of himself. He would look at himself in a mirror. He had the loaded forearm with the metal plate from the motorcycle accident. He was a heel. But Vince looked at him and said, we can make this guy the new all-American babyface. You knew he was replacing Hogan because it was the same thing with the stars and the stripes. It was like a carbon copy of Hogan that he was trying to produce here. And so they did the whole thing on the Intrepid on July 4th, where Yokozuna was going to, you know, people were going to try to slam Yokozuna. They brought in football players and retired football players and other wrestlers and all people from all walks of life and sports to try to pick this guy up. And some of them, you know, came a little close, but obviously nobody slammed Yokozuna. And if any of the NFL guys were legit trying to get him up, he would just deadweight them. You get a guy who's 520 pounds just deadweighting you. I mean, you got to be the Incredible Hulk to pick that person up. So then all of a sudden the chopper, right, off in the distance, it lands on the helipad. And here comes Lex Luger, and he's wearing this red, white, and blue stars and stripes, you know, sweater. And it's like a switch got flipped, and overnight he just went from being this completely conceited, self-absorbed heel to being the all-American babyface who cares about the red, white, and blue and the good old US of A and all the fans. He slammed Yokozuna, if you can call it a slam, he slammed Yokozuna. And everybody went nuts. The Intrepid thing was actually really cool as far as doing something like that in that kind of setting. It was cool, and you have to at least give them credit for putting that together and trying. They tried their ass off to try to get this guy over. Then came the Lex Express. They commissioned a bus. They put Lex Luger on a bus for about 6 or 7 weeks, crisscrossing all over the country. Although Bruce Pritchard says he did fly to some places, Luger said they would fly him home to give him a day or two with his family. He had a baby daughter at the time who was only about a year or two old. But it all built to the Lex Express pulling in to the Palace for SummerSlam at the big championship match, Luger challenging Yokozuna for the title. I think this was the year they brought in Aaron Neville to sing. Was it America the Beautiful? I think it was. They went all out trying to get this guy over. And you would watch all of this and figure there's no way he's leaving without that championship. Everything pointed to there being a title change on this show. Everything. They have the match. The match itself is really nothing special. Luger hits Yoko in the head with the loaded forearm and knocks him out of the ring. Yokozuna is out. He is out on the floor, unconscious. The referee starts counting. Luger's counting along with the ref. And he rings the bell and people cheer at first. And Luger is celebrating. He's like practically jumping up and down. He's so happy he just won this match. And I remember even as a young fan then, not some cynical podcaster here or an analyst, but watching it just as a young fan thinking, this is the stupidest thing that I've ever seen. What is he celebrating about? You didn't win the championship. But the idea is that Vince McMahon felt the biggest attraction that he had for WrestleMania 10 was Luger winning the title. This was not Luger having heat. This was not Luger being buried. This was not Luger being in the doghouse. Same thing with WrestleMania, by the way, the following year. It's been an urban legend for so many years that Luger was drunk at a bar or something the night before WrestleMania spouting off about, I'm going to win the title. It's bullshit. It's just such a complete bullshit. The fact is that they waited too long. That's what happened. This was the time to do the title change. Vince thought he could put it off and build it up a little bit more for WrestleMania the following year. The problem is, You put this man on a bus for 6 weeks, only for him to win by countout, and then celebrate as if he had just won the championship. Given, you know, the stipulation, you got to remember something else about the stipulation for this match too, which made it doubly stupid. The stipulation was that it would be Luger's one and only title shot. I think Jim Cornette in Storyline had worked it into the contract. Luger would only get one crack at the championship, and if he didn't win it, that was it. He wouldn't get another shot. So, again, I can understand Vince McMahon thinking, well, then Luger will win the Royal Rumble, and that's his way around the stipulation. But if you're a fan watching this, and you're watching Luger let the referee count this guy out, and then you're celebrating, why in God's name would he be celebrating if he knew in Storyline, well, I've only got one shot here to win this championship? It's like all they accomplished here was making Lex Luger look like a damn fool. And by the time the Royal Rumble rolled around, yeah, he still had fans. It's not like he was being booed out of the building, but people, they had a different favorite. They wanted Bret Hart to win. They wanted Bret Hart to win the Royal Rumble. They wanted Bret Hart to win the championship, and that's why they made the change. And Lex Luger never did win the WWF title, not even for a few minutes at WrestleMania that night. Yokozuna beat him again. And Bret Hart ended up being the champion, all because Vince McMahon felt he could drag this out. But the entire time, it was all, it didn't matter. Because the way this all played out with the stipulation, Luger looked like an idiot. Why would people cheer for someone like this? He looked like a fool. 26 years ago this week, on September 4th, 1995, a day that, without exaggeration, changed the wrestling business forever and kicked off the Monday Night War. It was the debut of WCW Monday Nitro, live on TNT from the Mall of America. It all began in a meeting with Ted Turner, where Eric Bischoff was pitching him on the idea of licensing WCW programming to some Chinese broadcasting company owned by Rupert Murdoch. All of a sudden, in the middle of Bischoff's presentation, Turner interrupts as if he wasn't even paying attention. He just interrupts him and says, "What would it take to compete with Vince McMahon?" And so Bischoff now has only a few seconds to think of an answer, because he wasn't expecting this. Bischoff said, "A primetime television slot." And that led to billionaire Ted turning to the president of TNT in this meeting and telling him to give Eric 2 hours on the network every Monday night. Now, why the Mall of America? Well, Eric Bischoff says it was a matter of camouflaging a larger problem, which is that WCW, at the time, was having trouble getting fans to attend their television tapings. So, you know, doing Nitro from a unique location with fewer people would help disguise that problem. And that may well be true. I'm not even saying that he's lying when he says that. And I liked it, by the way. I thought it was a cool setting. But I'm sure it had absolutely nothing at all to do with the fact that their biggest star, Hulk Hogan, just so happened to have a new restaurant that opened up inside the Mall of America called Hulk Hogan's Pasta Mania. They sold all sorts of pasta, including little pastas shaped like Hogan. You can find the old menu. It's floating around online. It had the Hulkster's favorite international pastas from around the world, with a special menu for the little pasta maniacs. Among the items that you could dine on, they had Hulk's Power Pasta, which was penne pasta, chicken, veggies, and your choice of sauce. Or, for the little pasta maniacs, they had Hulkaroni and cheese. They had cheeseburger pasta, which sounds disgusting. Or they had something called Hulkios, whatever the fuck that is. Maybe that was the Hulk-shaped pasta that I saw a picture of. The restaurant would shut down within months, so it was outlasted by the Nitro Grill and WWF New York. The very first match on Nitro pit Flying Brian Pillman one-on-one against Jushin Thunder Liger. Hell of a way to start the Nitro era. Lex Luger made a shocking appearance straight off WWF television during a match between Sting and Ric Flair. Right at the very beginning of the match, there's Luger. He's standing in the aisleway. He's got this like buttoned up white shirt. Looks like the puffy shirt that Jerry Seinfeld wore on that one episode of Seinfeld. And he's just watching. He's got his hands, I think, crossed or on his hips or whatever. But just his mere presence, it sent people into a tizzy because he was just at SummerSlam. He was just the day before tagging with Shawn Michaels, I think against Owen Hart and Yokozuna in a match up in, I want to say Newfoundland, Canada, at a WWF live event. And here he is showing up on the opposition. And he showed up later in the show to confront Hulk Hogan. That set up a match between the two of them for the championship on TV the following week, after Hogan retained his title on this night against Big Bubba Rogers. Now, on that first night, Nitro ran unopposed, but head-to-head against Raw in the weeks that followed, Nitro was instantly competitive. And the two shows traded wins back and forth until the following June, after the NWO arrived, and that was when Nitro went unbeaten for 83 consecutive weeks. 23 years ago this week, on August 30th, 1998, the Highway to Hell rolled through Madison Square Garden for SummerSlam, which did the biggest pay-per-view buy rate ever for a SummerSlam with 700,000 buys. It was a good show with a great video package set to AC/DC's Highway to Hell that I still remember to this day. That video gets me amped up every time I go back and watch it. Jeff Jarrett lost a hair versus hair match to X-Pac, but the clippers they used on him after the match got clogged with Jarrett's hair, and it broke down, so they took a regular pair of scissors to his long golden locks. He never did get his head completely shaved. Waltman was not happy with his payoff from the match and told Jarrett when the two of them appeared together on the Pro Wrestling For Life podcast. He said, "I wasn't happy about it. As a matter of fact, I think I called you just to make sure we got the same, and we did. First, I called Vince, and I was like, 'Vince, hey man, when did you start paying by the pound?' And he was like, 'Well, if that's how this conversation is going to go, then this conversation's over. You need to talk to Jim Ross about this.' So I used the same line on JR, and I got $5,000 extra for it. Every time I complained, they would send me an extra $5,000 to shut me up. When I make a call like that, it's not because I think I got shorted by $5,000. Honestly, it was half of what I thought it should have been. I'll be honest, it was $25,000, and I thought it should have been $50,000 for that match on that pay-per-view." Rock and Triple H had their classic ladder match for the Intercontinental title. Helmsley came into the match with a knee injury that he had suffered weeks earlier. This is one of the most important matches in Rock's career, really. His first great match, I would say, in WWE, and it's the one that turned him babyface the following month before he became the corporate champion and went right back to playing a heel at Survivor Series. But I would also argue that this right here was Triple H's second greatest moment, winning this match, his second greatest moment as a babyface, second only to that pop that he got when he returned to Madison Square Garden in 2002, when he came back from the quad injury, which was a tremendous ovation. I would put this, in terms of his babyface moments, at number two. I think him winning the title at the very end, the great call by Jim Ross, and that visual of the garden going nuts in the background as he pulled the belt down, I would say that that is even better than him winning both belts from Chris Jericho at WrestleMania 18, in front of 70,000 people, I think it was 68,000 people. This is a better babyface moment for Triple H. Unfortunately, his knee injury was such that he was forced to forfeit the title only a few weeks later to have surgery. I believe they were only supposed to go around 15 minutes with the ladder match, but they ignored their cues to go home, and they went about 11 minutes longer. Same thing Shawn Michaels and Razor Ramon did in the Garden in their first ladder match, which got them chewed out by Randy Savage when they got to the back, because an entire 10-man tag had to be bumped off the show and ended up taking place, I think, a week later on Monday Night Raw. And Stone Cold Steve Austin retained the WWF Championship over The Undertaker. Not their best match, largely because Austin was knocked out only minutes in. He was only knocked out for a few seconds, but it was pretty brutal. Austin tells it like this. If you watch the footage anyway, it looks pretty nasty. Austin tells it like this. We were out there trying to work our ass off, and prior to the match, I'm not the toughest guy in the world, but I've never been knocked out in my life. I hit the ropes, Undertaker goes for a backdrop, I kick him in his chest, he goes to straighten up and no-sell it, and when he does, the back of his big-ass head hits me right under the chin, and boom, knockout blow. I went down on the mat, I was knocked out, I was only knocked out maybe 2 or 3 seconds, all of a sudden I'm laying on the mat on my back in Madison Square Garden. I don't know where I am. The referee for the match was Earl Hebner. Earl looks down at me. He kind of has this little grin on his face. He goes, "God dang, boy, are you all right?" I looked up at Earl. I said, "Where am I?" He goes, "God damn it, boy, you're in the garden." So I get up and we continue the match. And one of my biggest disappointments in that match was that we were on our way to a hell of a match and I got knocked out. And from that point on, I don't remember the rest of that match. I remember laying on the table. I remember Undertaker getting up on the top turnbuckle and dropping that leg, and I'm thinking, we kind of talked about it, I don't know if he's going to do it or not, but I was going to stay there anyway because that's what you do. But all of a sudden, that's one of the things I do remember about that match was Undertaker dropping that leg off that top turnbuckle. I'm like, all right, this is going to be interesting. He lands, everything crashes, and we finish the match. Yeah, and I was thinking, as I was putting all this together, what is, in my opinion, the best Steve Austin Undertaker match that I've seen? Because they had so many of them. They had pay-per-view matches, they had TV matches, never had a WrestleMania match. Although I do wonder if they would have in 2000, had both of them actually been healthy and been on that card, which would have been very interesting as far as the streak is concerned. But I look back at their matches, and I think the one that I enjoyed the most and I thought was maybe the best match they had was at the Fully Loaded pay-per-view in 99 when they had that first blood match. It was a Ministry Undertaker against Steve Austin. If you know, Austin won, Vince McMahon would have to leave. I remember that being a pretty damn good match with a great finish, too. You know, Jim Ross on the call yelling at Earl Hebner because Undertaker's bleeding. Look at him, look at him, ring the damn bell. That was a great match. That might have been the best match they had. 20 years ago this week, on the September 3rd, 2001 episode of Raw is War from Toronto, the second to last Raw. I should say the second to last Raw is War before 9/11 happened. And they shortened the name of the show back to just Raw. I guess they thought it was in poor taste to call the show Raw is War, given that the country was going to war. After watching his brother, they were still brothers back then, watching his brother Edge win the King of the Ring and then win the Intercontinental title at SummerSlam, you know, Edge's singles career was really taking off. Christian had grown jealous, but he had a chance to become a champion himself on this night, challenging The Rock for the WCW title. He did not succeed. And later in the show, Edge beat Lance Storm to retain his IC title. And when Storm attacked Edge after the match, Christian ran down with a steel chair to make the save. Christian grabbed Edge's King of the Ring trophy that he was still carrying around with him and handed it to him. And then he took the chair and he clobbered him over the head with it, turning heel. And then he delivered a one-man concerto to his brother. Christian! At last, you're on your own. Christian would win the Intercontinental title from Edge the following month at Unforgiven before losing it back to him in a ladder match at No Mercy in October. 19 years ago this week on September 2nd, 2002, Monday Night Raw was in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where Raw General Manager Eric Bischoff reintroduced the big gold belt by presenting it to Triple H out of a briefcase, and declaring him the new World Heavyweight Champion by virtue of him defeating The Undertaker in a number one contenders match for the Undisputed Championship the week before. That was before Brock Lesnar took the title with him over to SmackDown. So Triple H won a number one contenders match for a title that really didn't belong on Monday Night Raw anymore. I thought it was incredibly dumb to just hand the belt over to him instead of having him win it. You know, you do a tournament, you give him a bye into the semifinals or something. you know, given that he won the number one contenders match. And then you do the finals between him and Rob Van Dam at Unforgiven, which was the match they ended up doing anyway for the championship. But I guess they thought this would put a ton of heat on Triple H by just handing him the belt this way. You know, doing the exact same finish they did at the pay-per-view with Ric Flair helping Triple H would have accomplished the same goal if it was the finals of a tournament too, I'm just saying. The concept of a brand split is not a bad one, but outside of maybe those first few years, this is not a company that ever understood how or cared how to properly do a brand split. 6 years ago this week, on September 1st, 2015, 32 years after the death of his road girlfriend, Nancy Argentino, Superfly Jimmy Snuka, at the age of 72, was arrested and charged with third-degree murder and involuntary manslaughter in her death. I've covered this extensively on this podcast before, multiple times, including my review of the Dark Side of the Ring episode they did on this subject, so I'm not going to recap all of it again here. Just one day after his arrest, WWE issued a statement saying Jimmy Snuka's non-wrestling Legends contract has been suspended and we are currently removing his images from our media platforms pending the outcome of this case. In November, he entered a plea of not guilty, and his lawyers argued that his mental and physical health were not good. He was diagnosed with stomach cancer. A judge later ruled him incompetent to stand trial and the charges were dropped, which does not mean he is innocent, it just means that they felt he could not stand trial. Justice delayed is justice denied for the Argentino family. But at least he was charged. Small victory, but at least he was charged. Which never would have happened were it not for a story in the local paper 30 years later, 30 years after her death, bringing everything back to the forefront again. I still want to know what was in that briefcase that Snuka, in his book, said Vince McMahon had on him when he met privately with the cops all those years ago. When they decided, immediately after that meeting, they decided not to pursue any charges against Jimmy Snuka, even though it seemed like there was certainly enough circumstantial stuff going on there to at least pursue this, and they opted not to. And especially when you consider the fact that Snuka was telling the cops and he was telling the hospital staff that night about three or four or five different versions of what he claimed happened. You don't think that's not suspicious? You don't think this should not have been investigated a little more closely? What was in that briefcase? You give me three questions to ask Vince McMahon one day, and that's going to be one of them, I guarantee it. Not that I expect an answer out of him. He's fucking old too now. Is he 76? He might not remember. 3 years ago this week, on September 1st, 2018, there are really two events that set the stage for the rise of All Elite Wrestling. The main thing that got the ball rolling was the Chris Jericho-Kenny Omega match in Japan at Wrestle Kingdom. Tony Khan has stated without that match, there would be no AEW. And it was actually Don Callis who put that match together and helped facilitate it. So, if in a roundabout kind of way, you could thank Don Callis for there being an AEW, but that's beside the point. But even before that match took place, there was a tweet that Dave Meltzer posted. Meltzer was replying to a fan asking if he thought that Ring of Honor could ever sell out an arena with 10,000 plus fans like Madison Square Garden. And Dave said, not anytime soon. That was in May of 2017 when he said that. Cody Rhodes saw that and he responded. He said, I'll take that bet, Dave. I already gave them their biggest buy rate. Put the Bucks and I on the card and 3 months to promote. And he tagged Ring of Honor in the tweet, who he was wrestling for at the time. It took longer than 3 months, but on this date in 2018, Cody and the Bucks co-promoted with a little help from Ring of Honor, who I believe helped on the production end, and I believe they still own the footage of this show. They produced an independent wrestling pay-per-view called All In from the Sears Center in Chicago, which today is the Now Arena, the site of tonight's All Out pay-per-view, selling it out with more than 11,000 fans in attendance. That includes over 10,000 tickets that were sold out in the first 30 minutes that they were put on sale in May. And that was with only one match announced. They brought Sean Mooney in to do, I think, one or two backstage interviews. Stephen Amell, who worked with Cody in WWE in that tag team match at SummerSlam, the star of Arrow, lost to Christopher Daniels in a singles match. Tessa Blanchard won a fatal four-way over Madison Rayne, Chelsea Green, and Britt Baker, who came out to Adam Cole's old Ring of Honor entrance music. Isn't it amazing? Tessa came off as the star of this match. Britt was still very much an unknown and relatively inexperienced. And here we are 3 years later. Britt Baker is the AEW Women's Champion, one of the most over stars in the entire promotion. And Tessa has fallen off the face of the earth. How quickly things can change. Cody won the NWA World's Heavyweight Championship from Nick Aldis, but only held it for 7 weeks before losing it back to Aldis at the NWA 70th anniversary show, a reign that would last for 1,043 days until last Sunday at the 73rd anniversary show. The low point of this show, well, and I'm not even saying this just in hindsight because the guy's a scumbag. I mean, I said this at the time. I thought this was fucking stupid. The low point of the show was the Joey Ryan stuff with the penis druids after the match between Adam Page and Joey Janela. It's even creepier now to look back at it, but even when it happened, like I said, it was stupid. The biggest reason I ripped on it when I reviewed this pay-per-view back on episode 562 was because had they not done this shit, the main event, which felt like it was shortchanged, could have had a few extra minutes added to it. Kenny Omega beat Pentagon Jr. in a great match with Chris Jericho after the lights went out post-match, showing up as a surprise cameo dressed as Penta, hitting a codebreaker on Omega. Kazuchika Okada from New Japan Pro Wrestling appeared on the show beating Marty Scurll, and Kota Ibushi was on the show tagging with the Young Bucks in the main event with a win over Rey Mysterio, Rey Fénix, and Bandido. They got a lot of names for this show. No CM Punk, though. I know they were in Chicago and people thought Punk might be there. Here we are now 3 years later. Better late than never. But make no mistake, the success of this show is still being felt today. AEW getting a deal with TNT and all of the success that they've had really can be traced back to the success of All In and everything that came after that. 2 years ago this week, on August 31st, 2019, AEW produced its first all-out pay-per-view in Chicago, the sequel to All In 1 year earlier, which was not an AEW show because there was no AEW yet. Nyla Rose won the Women's Casino Battle Royal, last eliminating Britt Baker. Jon Moxley had a staph infection that took him out of his scheduled match with Kenny Omega, so AEW turned a negative into a positive and replaced Moxley with the Bastard Pack and gave us a surprising finish, surprising to me at least, with Omega passing out in Pac's Brutalizer submission, handing Pac the win. Jimmy Havoc defeated Darby Allin and Joey Janela in a three-way Cracker Barrel clash. And here we are 2 years later, and Darby is one of the biggest stars in the company. Janela is an afterthought, and Jimmy Havoc is out of wrestling altogether, working for a delivery service. The Lucha Bros retain their AAA tag team titles with a win over the Young Bucks in a ladder match. And here we are tonight at All Out. The Bucks and the Bros meet again, this time inside a steel cage. After the match, both teams were attacked by Bill Clinton and JFK, or two men wearing Bill Clinton and JFK masks. Those two men turned out to be Santana and Ortiz, the former LAX from Impact Wrestling who were being courted by both WWE and AEW. They made their choice, and their choice was AEW. And Chris Jericho beat Hangman Adam Page to become the first ever AEW World Champion. It was the correct decision at the time. Jericho was the established name. Hangman was not. It would have been way too soon for him to win it. And it was backstage after the match, during his celebration, that Jericho decided to partake in a little bit of the bubbly. And a whole new line of merchandise was born. He got that line, by the way, from Jim Carrey in the movie Dumb and Dumber. There are still people who think he came up with that on his own. He did not. After winning the championship, Jericho promptly lost it. But not in the ring. He filed a police report the Monday after the pay-per-view, claiming that he left the belt inside his rented limousine while he ate dinner at a Longhorn Steakhouse in Tallahassee, Florida. Jericho said, "Unfortunately, less than 24 hours after I became the first AEW champion, with blood streaming down my face after one of the hardest matches I've ever had in my life, some low-life scumbag committed grand larceny and robbed me of the AEW championship." So he was trying to turn all the publicity into a storyline. He was vowing to get detectives from all over the world to find out who stole the belt. But the day after the news broke, police recovered the belt, with the story being that someone found it on the side of the road and turned it in. That person claimed that he and his wife thought it was a knockoff belt, and they went to go sell it on Craigslist when they started getting messages about the stolen belt. And they realized it was real. And that's when they went to the police with it. When he got to the station, he ran into the owner of the limo company that gave Jericho a ride to the steakhouse. The owner was getting ready to file an insurance claim for the belt and was so happy to find that it was recovered, he gave the person who turned it in $200 as a reward. He returned a $30,000 belt and got $200 in return. And 1 year ago this week, on episode 668 of The Sound Off, I brought back This Week in Wrestling History after a six-year absence. And it has been a lot of fun going back down memory lane and learning some new things along the way myself that I didn't know before. I hope that you've enjoyed the time and effort that went into putting these segments together every week. And we'll check back every now and then on the YouTube channel where every single one of these segments will be archived in a playlist. It's already there. And all the remaining, the remaining segments here will be on there as well. Anytime you want to refer back to them, they will be there. And I'll still be talking about historical stuff on the podcast. I mean, that's never going to stop. You know, maybe I'll do another countdown soon. It's been a while since I've done one of those. But for now, I will be able to start answering more of your email questions. Again, the return of the mailbag. And you can send those email questions to thesolomonster@gmail.com. And for the final time, that is This Week in Wrestling History. Join me later tonight. I am going to be live on YouTube as soon as All Out goes off the air, which will very likely not be until almost midnight or even just after midnight. These shows usually go very long because they only do four of them a year. So they try to squeeze as much into them as possible. But it's going to be a very fun show, I think, and I think it's going to be a very newsworthy show for a lot of reasons. So you will want to tune into this stream. We'll go over the good, the bad. If there's any ugly, we'll talk about that as well. We'll take your questions and super chats and have a good time and hang out. So come on by the YouTube channel. And now would be a great time to subscribe. Make sure the notification bell is in the on position. So when I do go live and get the page up, it should send you an email notification or some kind of maybe a push notification on your phone. I don't know what types of notifications you end up getting, but you will be made aware of that, and I will be back next Sunday for episode 721 of The Sound Off, because this train don't stop. This train keeps on going and going and going. I hope you all have a great Labor Day if you are here stateside, and maybe get a day off from work tomorrow. That would be nice. And those of our Jewish listeners out there, Happy New Year as you celebrate Rosh Hashanah this week. I hope you all have a fantastic week as well. Until next week, be well, stay safe, and I will see you right back here for more Sound Off next Sunday, as always. Until then, take care, guys.
The Solomonster Sounds Off.
Imagine if there was an NXT in 1990 and Mark Calloway finally found a gimmick that worked for him. He starts dressing like The Undertaker. He looks like a star. And then one day, he gets the call that every wrestler waits for. He's been booked for the Superstars taping. Only when he gets to the building, there's no smoke machine. There's no Paul Bear. There's no urn. They've completely stripped away all the elements that made The Undertaker work. And then they book him in his very first match to be rolled up and pinned by fucking Hillbilly Jim. If these people booked television back then the way they do now, they would have been lucky to have any stars.
The Sala Monster Sounds Off, available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesalamonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow the Sala Monster on Twitter @SalaMonster.
Sala Monster.
Put that cigarette out.
Sala Monster Sounds Off.